South African, and welcome to our meeting. Once a year, the committee is obliged to assess the performance and service delivery of the Department of Correctional Services and the Office of Inspecting Judge within the scope of the resources that we appropriated to them. And that process is going to start tomorrow when we engage with the inspecting judge, and on Tuesday with the Department of Correctional Services. And in preparation for those engagements, we afford an opportunity to any South African and every South African who would want to make a comment on the performance or lack thereof, service delivery or lack thereof of the department, so that we are, as a committee, better informed when we meet with them tomorrow and beyond. So that's the legal obligation that we have as a portfolio committee. And we're glad that you're here. We've afforded an opportunity to talk to any aspect of it that you'd want to talk to. And we will, as far as possible, try and cooperate in our engagement with the department tomorrow, next week, and the inspecting judge tomorrow. So I'll indicate from our side, ladies and gentlemen, that having gone through the annual report and the AG's financials, we are on record as saying that we are very concerned. 18 years down the line, and this department has not received anything other than a qualified report. The Auditor General is very clear in questioning the leadership capabilities of the accounting officer, and has listed a whole range of areas that he, as the Auditor General, thinks the accounting officer has failed on. So in terms of the financials, I think we're pretty much covered. But if you want to talk to, it's fine. We've got the AG here to elaborate on his findings. I really think we're more interested in the service delivery aspects of it. They come to us at the beginning of the year with a draft plan that says we will do A, B, C, D, please give us the money. And because we are now over, as the portfolio committee, we are anticipating that you'd be able to tell us what's happening on the ground from your point of view, so that we can raise it with them. I can indicate to you that of the plus minus 122 performance targets that they had identified, they've only achieved about 47% of it. And talking about 16 billion rand budget the year before, they've only achieved 47% of it. Now we're expecting that you would either elaborate on that or assist us in terms of how you think they should achieve a higher percentage than 47%, because that's really what we want to discuss with them tomorrow and on Tuesday. And in the process, culminated with us writing a report to Parliament with the proviso of suggesting amendments to the budget. That's really where it ends up. So this is a very important meeting for us. Because clearly, if they're only achieving 47% of their targets, then for me, they should have only spent 47% of their budget, because that budget is based on the targets that they have put before us. It doesn't make sense to spend 100% of your budget but only achieve 47% of the target. It just means that we are not as efficient and as effective as we should be as the Department of Correctional Services. That's really the mindset that we have as a portfolio committee. We are under no illusions that there are problems in this department. ours is not to be here and critical, but at the end of the day, we want to be able to say to the department, these are the things we think you should start doing to reach a stage of acceptance in terms of service delivery, or these are the things that we think you should stop doing because they're not adding value. We have quite a few stakeholders that have indicated they would want to participate. We've received your submissions. Thank you very much. I'm suggesting that we deal with the, after the Auditor General gives us his financials, deal with the aspect that affects the inspecting that. And I know many of your focus is on the department, but we'll ask those that want to focus on inspecting that to be the first to lead. I'm not sure who they are, but you would have your 10, 15 minutes to do that. And thereafter we'll have the discussions around the department. So if somebody has focused on both the inspecting judge and the department, we're asking you to find a way of splitting your 10 minutes up so that, or your 20 minutes up so that you can pay attention to both of them. What I'm saying is you've got 20 minutes. If you use it all up in the inspecting judge, don't think you have another bite in the other one, so that at least we are able to get through our business. We will... You want to say something there? Okay. No, it's fine. There are a few apologies from our side, so it's not because the committee is doesn't take this seriously. These two people are doing the same thing in agriculture, Mr. Abram and Paliso. Baba Jobu from the IFP has got some problems that he has asked to be excused for the rest of the week, and I'm sure members of the ANC will join us shortly, but we can't wait for them. 2 o'clock is the meeting, they'll join us shortly. So there should be only 3 apologies from the MP's side, and we're hoping others will join us, but if they don't, we'll continue with the business. I was saying that you have 20 minutes. You decide how you want to utilize your 20 minutes, and then we'll engage with that from a point of seeking clarity. We're really not going to take you on your observations, because those are your observations. We will then take them and apply them when we deal with the department. Of course, unless they are absolutely ridiculous, then we challenge you on them. But it's really about affording you an opportunity to further empower us so that we can deal with this crisis that we have before us. So we'll afford you all the opportunity. Members will only ask questions of clarity to empower them. And we'll find another day to debate whatever it is that you want to debate substantially. I'm not sure that we're going to introduce or indicate who's here, but can I ask that as you speak, you introduce yourself, otherwise we would just waste so much time. And as I said, there's more than 7 or 8 stakeholders. So as you speak, you'll say, this is who I am and this is who I represent. And you then can start your business. Can we, at this point, if people are comfortable, ask the Auditor General to then give us your input, sir? And on that one, we will ask questions, obviously, so that we just get a understanding, AG, very briefly, and then we will move on to our stakeholders who want to deal with the inspecting tax. And thereafter, we'll get on to stakeholders who want to deal with the DCF. Although you've got a program, but because I'm changing it, that program might change slightly. But I think it's the better way of managing it. AG, over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Chair. My name is Musa Shongwa from the Auditor General. My colleague is Solomon Tiana from the Auditor General as well. We're going to make a presentation on the audit outcomes for the department, and we look at the recent financial year that we just audited. I believe that we all have copies of the presentation that we're going to talk about, which is this presentation, the detailed one. If we go to page 3 of that presentation, that gives us the 4-year history of the audit outcome. You see that from year 08-09, year 09-10, year 10-11, and year 10-12, we have used red color for the audit account for the department. That means the department has received a qualified audit report. If you go down, looking at the qualification, we see that the areas of qualification were around the assets for all those years, for the 4 years, and there were other matters also that related to predetermined objectives. For example, that is the performance information, which were also qualified from year 9, 10, 11, and 11-12. Also for compliance with laws and regulations, the qualification was also for the 4 years, 4 years from 8-9 to 11-12. And also relating to material understanding of the budget, there were some findings in the 3 years, 9, 10, 10-11, and 10-12. If you go to the next page, the colorful page, that gives you the six focus areas that we look at during our audit. The first area being the supply chain management, the next one being the audit of predetermined objectives, that is the performance information, the other area being HR, the next one being IT, and the other one being the errors in financial statements that were submitted to us, and the last one being the financial health. Those are the six focus areas that we look at during our recent audit. The third area of supply chain management, you see in red, we had some findings, serious findings that related to issues like suppliers to listed, blacklisted suppliers, for example, who were listed by the National Treasury as suppliers that should not do business with the government. Also, some other supply contraventions of the supply chain management legislation, including the disclosure that should be made by people contracting with the department. Also, on predetermined objectives, there were some findings, serious findings, which related to the usefulness of information and also to the reliability of information. Although we're not yet issuing an opinion on the audit of predetermined objectives, we do audit the predetermined objectives and issue an opinion which only ends in the management report and not in the audit report. So in terms of that opinion, the department received an adverse opinion on the reporting of performance information. The other area relating to HR, that is the area relating to things like leave, for example, and to vacancies. There were also findings regarding that area, which raised some concerns, that I still read. Also on the IT, which is our other focus area, there were some serious findings, as things were not going very well in the IT department, and there's still a lot of work that needs to be done for that IT department to be where it should be. The other areas, area of errors in the financial statements that were submitted to us, the financial data submitted to us by the 31st of May are supposed to be submitted to us in the state where they should be sort of like final. But in this case, we had to, a lot of changes had to be made to the financials, which involved the errors that we found, so that they could be in a state where they could be tabled. So the tabled financials were after the errors that were corrected coming from us. The last area related to the financial health that relates to things like going concern or funding issues. There were no serious issues in that area. If you go to the next pages, we give a more detailed information about those focus areas. And I just ask my colleague, Soli, to take us through.
Thank you, Chair, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. As Musa has mentioned, below are the details of those areas that Mr. Musa has touched on. Firstly, the first area is on the supply chain management. The first point here is in regards to the information that we requested from the department to evaluate, for which we couldn't receive that information, as that information was still in the hands of the Hawks, busy with other investigation. This relates to contracts for Sondolo, and then it also relates to payroll security contracts. So those ones, we couldn't get hold of it to evaluate them. Okay? The second issue is on the awards that were actually made to suppliers that are listed as prohibited suppliers according to the National Treasury. The third one is the issue whereby some persons in the service of the department whose close family members, partners or associates had private businesses or private businesses or business interests in contract awarded by the department, and then they failed to disclose such interest. Okay. The next page is also relating to the same issues. It's where some persons in the service of the department who have private or business interest in contract awarded by the department failed to disclose such interest. So here, meaningfully, the person has got a business, and then his business received a contract from the department, and the person didn't say that he is a member in that particular organization. The third issue is whereby officials of the department perform remunerative work outside the department without the permission from the relevant authority. The third issue is on three quotations, goods and services that were procured without inviting three quotations. Okay, another issue is where procurement of goods and services were actually obtained from suppliers who didn't provide tax clearance to the department. Another area is on deviation from the competitive bidding, whereby the acquisition of goods and services was regarded as an emergency issue, whereby the situation or circumstances that we evaluated doesn't even warrant those issues to be actually dealt with as emergency. Okay. Another issue on the supply chain is one contract where that was extended without the approval of a delegated official. Okay. I think as far as the supply chain is concerned, those were the issues. The next issue on page number 6 is on the predetermined objective, that is a report on the predetermined objective. As Musa has mentioned, we've got two issues. The issue on the usefulness of information. Here we pick up that there's about 22% of reported indicators were not consistent with the, indicators as the approved strategic plan. The reason is the strategic plan was not consistent with the annual performance plan. The second one is on the reliability of information. Here we couldn't get supporting documentation with regards to the information on the eligible for other eligible offenders for partaking in the training program. So that information we requested from the department, and then we couldn't receive that information. Okay, then that led us to the limitation of scope. And then the next page is on the human resources. The first bullet, we could not satisfy ourselves that the accounting officer implemented effective measures to ensure that the sick leave is not abused. For example, the application for sick leave that was submitted or that approved after an unreasonably long period of time. And then the second issue, we requested information from the department, and then we could not receive it. This information also relates to the utilization of sick leave. Here, example is like where no sick leave certificate were received from the department supporting the amount that was paid for sick leave. And then the next issue is on the overtime, where you picked up that some of the employees, they receive overtime compensation that is in excess of 10% of the amount of salaries in contravention of the Public Service Regulation Act. So next page is page number 8. Page number 8 is also a limitation of scope, where sufficient or profit audit evidence could not obtain that monthly compensation for overtime was limited to 30% employees' monthly salary, as required by the public service regulation. So here is information on the details of overtime, for example, the number of days of overtime, or whether that overtime was approved by level of official. That is information could not obtain. Lastly, is on the performance and career management policy. During the time of audit, we pick up that that policy was still in a draft during the time of an audit. Okay. The next key focus area is on the IT technology controls. The first issue is on the IT governance framework. During the time of an audit, there was lack of IT and project governance framework from the IT section. Okay, next page number 9. The second issue on the information technology is where the key information technology positions were vacant at the 31st March 2012. These were two deputy commissioner positions that was actually vacant at the, during the year end. And also some of the positions in the IT department remained vacant for a substantial period of time, or they were filled towards the end of the financial year, including the GTO position. Okay, the next issue is on the information and communication system security policy that is designed but is not yet actually implemented. Okay, next page. Other issue is on the user access management procedures and processes that are not yet designed. And another issue is on the change control procedure that is not yet implemented by the department. And of course, the disaster recovery plan that is not designed as at the year end. Next page number 11. Here is on the data and the system backup and the restoration process that are not adequately designed and implemented by the department. Okay, next page is on the financial health status. Under financial health, the only issue we had concern with is the material underpinning of the budget of the DCS. But in any way, it should be noted that the saving was, part of the saving was used to fund the unauthorized expenditure that was picked up in the previous year. Okay, next page is page number 30. Here is on other compliance measures. On the strategic planning, here we picked up that the system that is used by the department to collect performance information is not adequate, since it's not actually assisting the department to report positively in terms of performance information. The other area is on the receivables, where outstanding debtors for 3 years and loan are not issued rigorously by the department to ensure that long outstanding amounts are collected or are written off. If you can check there, we've got outstanding debtors for 3 years and older that have increased by 18% compared to the previous year, and they consist of about 43% of the total outstanding debtors. Another area is on tangible capital assets, which forms a qualification for this for the financial year 11-12. Here, we've picked up that the controls, the safeguarding and maintenance of assets to prevent theft, losses, wastage, and misuse, as required by the Treasury regulation, was not there was not a proper control system for ensuring that there is this safeguarding and maintenance of these assets. Next page is on the issue of comparative figures. If you can check on your annual report on the audit report itself, if you we remember very well last year during financial year 10-11. We have qualified the department on the issues of additions and disposals, where additions and disposals were materially misstated. So when we received the financial statements this year, we have seen the comparative figures still indicating the figures that were that was qualified last year, meaning nothing was done on those figures. So what we did, we said, department, can you please make adjustments to those figures, because of these figures basically are materially misstated as they were in the previous year. So what the department has done, has made an adjustment on those figures. Okay, after they've made those adjustments, So we requested the department to give us supporting information for those adjustments so that as creditors we can satisfy ourselves on the assertion. Namely, we wanted to make sure whether those adjustments are complete and whether the asset concern exists and whether the information is accurate and actually the transaction has occurred. So out of the information that they have given us, we could not satisfy ourselves to the completeness of those adjustments. Then for which they amounted to a monetary amount of approximately 10 million. Okay. Another issue is on the asset register for both measures. This is the current year finding relating to the 11-12. We picked up that asset register for both major and minor assets were also materially misstated. There were assets that were not captured on the asset register, and there were also assets that could not be physically identified. Furthermore, the asset register was also not fair valued, since amounts used for some assets could not be substantiated by department. Okay. Okay, another area apart from asset management is on the expenditure management by the department. Here we have picked up issues whereby the accounting officer did not always take effective steps to prevent irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. Another area, it was on the accounting officer where he did not always ensure effective internal controls were in place for payment approval and processing as required by the Treasury Regulation. And then the second issue is also the limitation of scope where sufficient appropriate risk evidence could not be obtained in all instances that all monies are spent with approval of the accounting officer or properly authorized person. Another issue is where creditors are not always paid within 30 days. Another issue is where payments were made in advance of the department receiving goods and services, and that is in contravention of the Treasury Regulation stated there. Okay, I think as far as the key focus area, that was the last item. Page number 17 is just a summary. It is a commitment by the executive. On the 5th of July, we met with the Honorable Minister. And then at that date, we discussed preliminary findings with him, whereby he made a commitment to come back to Auditor General on a quarterly basis, to actually brief Auditor General on the progress of the implementation of the action plans to address the identified deficiencies. Other matters of interest, of course, is two issues. Okay, for the current year, there were no unauthorized expenditure with PIPA. We were concerned about fruitless and wasteful expenditure of about 71.3 million. That was actually identified by auditors during the audit for which management couldn't pick up before the auditor came for auditing. Another one is irregular expenditure. That is about 214 million. That was also identified by the auditors during the audit. I think that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions of clarity from members? We're not interrogating the Auditor General, just questions of clarity to Sustat, Mr. Self, and then Advocate Max, and then Mam Gwanya.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for running through this. I would like to ask a general question and then a specific question. The general question sounds in the recommendation column, and there are a number of specific things that are recommended to ensure compliance. But, you know, this has been, the chairperson said, an ongoing situation for the last 17 years. And at no stage is there a recommendation that flows from the PFMA that people should be held individually accountable for the material difficulties and qualifications that arise out of the report. At what stage in the Auditor General's opinion is that an appropriate step that should be taken, because clearly not even the recommendations that are made year after year are themselves implemented by the department, hence the fact that year after year you come back with the same qualifications and the same recommendations. The second question that I'd like to ask in a more specific way is relating to supply chain management. And you say in one of the bullets that four deviations from competitive bidding to the value of some 4.1 million rands were picked up. In another bullet, you talk about the fact that three quotations were not received for amounts under 500,000 rand. Now, we heard yesterday from the department that a very substantial contract, the value of nearly 500 million rand, for fencing had been awarded by using the Independent Development Trust rather than going through what would ordinarily be a procurement process involving a tender in the Tender Gazette, a whole process of competitive tendering. What is the regulation that is acceptable to the Auditor General as far as a competitive bidding for amounts over 500,000 rand? What process has to be followed?
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members have already touched on certain issues. I just want to rest on what he said. You know, it seems that if the audit, the AG, actually dealt with papers which the department are not dealing with, because I can't think how on earth can you make these mistakes. Genuine, I mean, objectively speaking. Secondly, I just want to understand the responsibility of the Auditor General. If you, in your pursuance and your checks and balances, which you apply, if you come across something to that effect, which might amount to maladministration and, under certain circumstances, a criminal act, are you not legally obliged to refer those instances to the relevant entities like Scorpions or the public protector? I think, in my view, first view, some of these things need to be checked by the public protector. The reason why I'm saying it, if you look at page 60, page 60 indicates they didn't comply with the 3 days payment of service providers. Yeah, the second paragraph from the bottom. But just below it, some companies are paid in advance. Huge contradiction. Now, did you pursue this? Why was the one paid in advance and the other one, others, not even paid in the established principle of 30 days? Is it a company which just exists? If you ever got the money, buy from the original supplier, via me to the department, you know, create a company for a BE or whatever the case may be. So that's my point for now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I apologize for coming late. I was fixing my paper for SARS at 8th floor. Chairperson, I'd like to thank you for the report from the Audit General, but I also wanted to get a clarity, Chair, in terms of the recommendation. Some recommendation, Chair, doesn't have a time frame. I wanted to know that how is the department going to push themselves if they didn't put the time frame, because it shows, Chair, that there's a lot of things that is not right in terms of the department. And two, Chair, on page 5, in terms of bullet 4, in some of instance, quotations were procured from supply who did not have tax clearance from SARS, confirmed that their tax matters are in order. There's no recommendation saying. And Chairperson, if you could remember yesterday, there was this challenge of members of correctional service that are doing work that they are not even supposed to do. For example, the member that is on the human resource, dealing with human resource, he said he was hired to be a security. Then there was this question, if ever he's hired as security, but he's doing human resource, and what is going to happen in terms of about his salary? So the your report is good. It shows good. There's a lot of work need to be done in terms of the correctional service we employment in Yabo. So I think Chairperson, a time frame, because if department doesn't have a time frame, they still next year we are going to get a report that is having a problem like this one. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. If I may start with the last question, where, for example, we make recommendations and there is no time frame. Our recommendations are audit recommendations. The audit is done for the purposes of enabling us to issue an opinion on the financial statements. We report to management in the first place by way of management report. We sit down and discuss with management the issues that we found. And as the custodian of the department, then we leave it up to management to take further steps, whether it be to come up with action plans as to how they're going to address the situations that we have highlighted in our audit report. It is those action plans that are going to then have time frames, because they must commit themselves as to when they are going to implement those recommendations or other ways in which they're going to fix the problems. We do this also when we meet with the minister. We have meetings quarterly with the ministers where we also evaluate these issues that we find during our audits, and we get commitment. Somewhere in our document, we are talking about commitments. We secure commitment from the minister to address these issues. And then when we do audits, also we do follow up on the action plans that were given to us to make sure that to find out if they have been implemented. The other question related to what do we do when we come up with these findings year after year. At some one stage, do we hold someone accountable for making good those findings that we have made? In that case, we also make recommendations that discuss management, and it is the responsibility of management to fix the problem. Ours is to report on the problem. And if we see that those problems are not fixed year after year, of course, we are going to escalate the issues to oversight bodies like the audit committee, like the minister, and even like the scope of the portfolio committees. I'll just ask Tori to respond to other questions.
Okay, thank you. Just to add on the time frame issue, Musa touched on the management report. Basically, in the management report, we've got some sort of a time frame, but this is like we categorize our findings. There are those findings that we categorize, we tell management that they just need an immediate action from management, and we put them in a different annexure. And then for this separate annexure, we say, management, these are findings that you should actually resolve within 12 months. If you don't resolve within 12 months, they can accumulate to an audit report. And then we've got administrative methods. Those methods, they can be rectified in the discretion of the department. Those are PT issues. That's how we deal with the time frame issues. Yeah. Coming to the issue of process to be followed, when you talk about goods and services that are over 500,000, our concern is like we should follow the proper bidding process, whereby they advertise the tender, and then they give the community an equitable chance to partake in that particular tender. And then the proper process of inviting the application, evaluation of the application, and formal selection process takes place until the final winning bidder is awarded the contract. And then below 500,000, the laws and regulations require them to have obtain a history quotation, unless it is an issue that is regarded as an emergency. There's nothing that they could have done other than just acquiring that good services immediately. But now there are situations or other the conditions that they need to meet before they actually deviate from proper supply chain management policy. And that should be endorsed or other approved by the relevant authorities in management. Okay. Reference of issues to SCOPA, I think Musa has touched on that. The other one is on the tax clearance. I think it's already discussed that. Company paid in advance and 30 days. That one, we didn't specifically check whether the ones that could not be paid within these days, the situation of those companies, we didn't check. We just checked whether those companies are paid within 30 days and the others are paid in advance, but we didn't separate them from the ones that are not paid within 30 days. So we are not sure whether the criteria the department has used to actually maybe select the ones that they want to pay in advance, whatever, we didn't check that. Yes, I think that's everything.
I think that one is relating to situations where we see that the actions are maybe of a criminal nature or of a nature similar to that. What do we do in the case? We do report that to management. We also have a small investigation department within our office where in the case where we see an indication that might relate to fraud or that kind of situation, then we do ask an expert from our side to look at that, and if there are further confirmations, then we're going to ask the management to investigate.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, there's one question that I forgot. The issue of Sondolo and Pezulu that was not awarded that the audit said it was not reported or there were no accountability on it. I want to get clarity there, Chairperson, that if there was no accountability, when is going to be audited, because Chair, I've got a problem of this system that is on this IT things that is in our center. Well, it's not working since almost 3 years, and now even now there's no report on it. I don't know how I'm going to solve this problem. Can I get a clarity from the audit about it? Thanks.
I just one clarity from the AG with regards to page four and five, where you state that some persons in the service are prohibited from doing business as well as those close family members and partners and associates at private or business interests and contracts, as well as on page five, the top column. Is that an assumption or is it a fact? Is it determinate that serving members, top management, middle management, got that interest? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Okay, to start with the first one, the Sondolo. What we basically wanted to do with that information, we wanted to check whether the supply chain process was followed properly. So when we went to management to ask for the information, so they said that information is in the hands of Hawks. So basically we could not satisfy ourselves whether the procurement process that was followed in those contracts was in accordance with laws and regulations. So up until maybe if it falls within our sampling, the current financial year, we will still share that. But now we cannot say anything at this point in time. Okay. The second one, yes, we went through the cycle where we check the members of those companies that received business from the correctional services. And then from the province house, we picked up that some of the members, they are waiting for the Department of Correctional Services. But now, in the tender documents, those people didn't actually declare that they belong to those companies. Thank you, Chair.
If I can just add to this one. When we make findings, we discuss those findings with the engineer to verify them, to give them a chance to discover if they made a mistake. So that was agreed upon. No, that is mentioned that we found that.
I wanted to get into the last bit that you raised, AT. You make a finding, you discuss it with management. So you discuss with management that member ABC is in fact a member of DC Midstream Business. That's discussed, they've got that information. And to answer Mr. Mather's question, it's a fact. Now, the problem that I have, and members must raise it tomorrow or next week, the problem that I have, when we look at your report, you say investigation pending. Clearly, if it's a fact that Vincent is a member of DCS, he got that tender, what is it that we are investigating, sir? What is it that we're investigating? Because that's the status on those reports. I mean, that's the question that members must ask tomorrow. What is there to investigate? I don't know, just do that. And in fact, for the interest of members, I did ask Cindy to get from the department the actual names of the individuals, because your report just says there are some individuals. As soon as we get the names of those individuals, we'll share it with you. We've asked the department to give us. Or yourself, you are here now. You can't make that statement that there are people. It would be helpful if you give us the names, so that we're able to say to the department, member X, is in the department, but he's got that contract. We ask the department if you can give that to us, it will be helpful before Tuesday. It can resolve that problem. Thank you very much. I just thought we must, the chair of the audit committee is here and the internal audit is here. It's very clear that all the basics have not been carried out here. I mean, you don't do three quotations. We know when we take our car for a panel visa, we need to, even if we do it underhand, we still come with three pieces of paper. I don't understand how the department doesn't know it. I don't understand how internal audit can't pick the thing up. There's nothing here earth-shattering in terms of what they've done. They haven't got the audits. They're doing business with prohibited people. They are doing business with members of the staff. All those things are basic. We would expect that internal audit and the audit committee are able to pick those things up for us as well. I know that you've just started off today. I mean, when I say started off, it's not in your term. But I can tell you that half of these things are carrying on even today. It might not be your fault that it was there in 2010, 2011, but you sat with us in the quarterlies, and many of these things are happening even now in your term of office as the Oversight Committee. So you indicated that you give it to the Oversight Committee. The question that must ask the Oversight Committee is, are you really doing what you needed to do with this? Or are you just guessing it, acknowledging it, and keeping it to yourself? I'm saying this is a comment. The one point I wanted to raise, AB, and I want you to answer it for us so that we raise it. The targets on the strat plan, the output is unqualified audit opinion expressed by the AG, and this is their annual performance plan for the last financial year. The performance indicator says number of audit qualifications and the target for this year, for the year 2011-2012, reduced level of deficiencies using the 2010-2011 AG report. Did they not reach their target, in your opinion? I'm saying their target was to reduce the level of deficiencies in this financial year using the last financial year AG's report. The question that I'm asking is, have they, in your opinion, achieved that target? Because that's the point we want to put in. You put this target there, in my own view, I don't think they've achieved it. I want to find out from you. Do you think that these guys have achieved that target?
Honorable Chair, in my opinion, they have not achieved it. looking at qualifications of 2011 and of 11 and 12, there is no noticeable improvement.
Assistant members, as we engage with the department. Thank you very much, AG. You're free to sit and observe, or you are free to leave if you have other engagements. I think you indicated that you want to leave, but whenever you want to leave, you can leave. Thank you very much for that. Can we move on to anybody who wants to make any input in terms of the inspecting judge's annual report? Can we have an indication first who would want to make those? Okay, Mr. Munting, and then Nico, just those two. Okay, and Mr. Munting, if you can kick off first, I'm assuming that it is in your presentation.
Yeah.
Members have got the presentation, so as you talk, if you refer to whatever pages on that presentation, members can then follow you in that regard. I'm assuming everybody's got the presentation. Yes.
Mr. President, just a remark. I have noticed you mentioned Mr. Mochi. I checked the last page of his presentation and I saw that there's a change. I would like to congratulate him on his doctorate.
Oh, congratulations, sir.
Thank you, Advocate Max, for that. I'm not going to go through the entire presentation and just touch on a few things. The presentation deals in a large part with the independence of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Service. Now, I understand there's another committee meeting scheduled for later this month to deal with this issue further, and the submission would then also bear relevance there, and I'm not going to go into that in any detail, but I think it is opportune that after 13 years of existence, that some review after inspectorate is required and that one assesses whether it is indeed achieving the stated objectives. The bulk of what I'll deal with here are the death in custody, and that starts on page 7 of the submission, and specifically unnatural deaths in custody. The 2011-12 annual report after inspectorate concludes, and I'm at the bottom of page 7, paragraph 20, as follows on the unnatural deaths in custody, and it reads, in respect of criminal investigations and disciplinary proceedings, the 2010-11 annual report indicated that the number of homicide cases that year had not been finalized. The inspectorate followed up on these cases, SAS closed the files in the majority of those cases, and where matters were referred to the National Prosecuting Authority for Prosecution, the NPA returned to not prosecute, i.e. they declined to prosecute. So if we look at the period from 2009 onwards, it then appears, as far as we could establish, that there had not been a single criminal prosecution of a DCS official implicated in the death of a prisoner. So we previously, in November 2011, raised this also with this committee, and identified a few traits. Those are summarized in paragraph 21. I move on to paragraph 22. The results of investigations reported by the inspectorate in this annual report therefore gives us little reason for optimism, but rather that the prevailing lack of criminal investigations perpetuates impunity. While there may be legitimate reasons why the Director of Public Prosecutions declines to prosecute, the lack of transparency in this regard draws one to conclude that all may indeed not be above board. It seems improbable that in the now substantial number of cases of unnatural deaths implicating DCA officials, that there was not one case that the DPP continued with the prosecution. The problems with investigations are not limited to deaths in custody, but also in respect of assaults. Assault cases are probably treated with even more disdain than deaths, as was illustrated clearly in the McCullum decision emanating from 2005. The lack of transparency is not only problematic in respect of the DDP's decisions, but also with reference to the investigations being undertaken by the department and SAP into unnatural death in custody. The lack of prosecutions may indicate that these investigations are not thorough or not sufficiently independent and impartial. In the case of DCS investigations, it appears that a matter of as serious as a death in custody due to unnatural causes, that a criminal investigation should take priority over an investigation from a disciplinary perspective. The DCS direct involvement in such an investigation where it has to interview witnesses, alleged perpetrators, and assesses material evidence seems to fly in the face of internationally accepted requirements that such investigations must be conducted by impartial and independent authorities. By virtue of the fact that the alleged perpetrator is an employee of the department is implicated because the death in question indicates a material failing on the part of the department to provide safe custody and uphold the right to life. The submission continues with reference to the UN principles on the effective prevention and investigation of extra-legal, arbitrary, and summary executions, and I think the inspectorate would be well advised to look at these principles when it investigates deaths in custody. I'm not going to go through that in detail. I move on to paragraph 27. So if we then measure against the above principles and the known results of investigations, we submit that the current situation with regard to the investigation of deaths in custody is highly unsatisfactory and requires urgent attention. Unless drastic changes are made to the current investigation regime, it is unlikely that more successful investigations and prosecutions will take place. It's ultimately in the interest of the department that deaths and assaults are properly investigated and that the perpetrators held criminally responsible. The department stands to gain nothing from the current situation, as it only perpetuates the impression that the department's leadership does not regard the rights of prisoners as a priority and by omission permits officials to conduct themselves with impunity. To this end, we submit that the Portfolio Committee conduct its own investigation into the problem and call on the National Prosecuting Authority, the police, the department and the inspector to provide clarity on how investigations are being conducted, the problem in investigation, how decisions to prosecute or not are made, and the current lack of criminal prosecutions implicating DCS officials in the deaths of prisoners. We further submit that a number of issues need to be explored, and firstly that the mandate of the inspectorate be expanded to give it investigative powers similar to those of the Independent Police Investigative Directorate, where it pertains to deaths in custody and allegations of torture, that the department is not permitted to conduct investigations into such matters until the inspector or similar suitable body has completed its investigations, and that the results of investigations and prosecutions be published annually by the inspector, including the reasons why the DPP has declined to prosecute where such a decision was made. We raise in paragraph 30 that the inspectorate identifies a number of problematic issues. In paragraph 32, we note that it is important that these concerns are reported, but we would like to see recommendations from the inspectorate how these issues can be improved or resolved. And we would trust that the inspectorate would provide such guidance to the department to address these particular concerns. I thank you, Chair.
Right, Mr.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon to the committee and to stakeholders and DCS. Just regarding the judicial inspectorate annual report, I just spoke with the comments that the inspecting judge made, which is that the judicial inspectors and the judge's role is to hold a magnifying glass to the treatment of inmates and the conditions of their detention as an important method of guarding against unjustifiable limitations of rights. And I think that's what the annual report sought to do. Yet, the CSPRI and ICRA also always remain concerned about the independence of the judicial inspectorate of correctional services. So we are very pleased about further deliberation regarding this matter. We can see in the report that there's been lots of structural changes. There's been a meeting with the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. So there's lots going on to look at the feasibility of establishing this office as an independent one. We know that there are lots of challenges and that this could probably cost more, but we hope that it would improve overall the oversight over the DCS. Just moving on to
the next page, on page number, point number six on page two, just looking at the judge's focus area on the treatment of children, there are currently 396 sentenced and 196 unsentenced children in our correctional facilities, which is still an area of concern. And I think annual report acknowledges that the judge will monitor implementation section 19 of the Correctional Services Act, that children will have access to compulsory education and educational programming, that every child prisoner to be provided with social work, recreational programs and psychological services, and that children remain in contact with their families for additional visits and by other means. And we know that these are going to be very challenging. We know the issue of critical and scarce skills and the challenges we've been having with the department around shortages of staff. And so we wish the judge well with that. And I mean, children are always a priority and a vulnerable group. With regard to moving on to administration, the question we had, we saw in the annual report about independent children visitors, and we were quite alarmed that in one center, Kaupeng particularly, that one independent children visitor, correctional services visitor, had to deal with 650 cases. And then I'd like to just ask the question, I know legislation says one independent visitor per prison, but is it adequate? And obviously, that would require legislative changes, but I see in the report it talks about a 1.7 person, and so it's just a question we wanted to ask. With regard to point number two, still under administration, I see the issue of Section 35.2E of the Bill of Rights refers to a resident detained and accused person having proper conditions and talked about at least exercise and provision of at state extent or whatever else. Now, the judicial inspectors time and time again have talked about exercise in previous reports, but I see in this particular report it has not been referred to. And I know personally this issue has not been addressed fully within the Department of Correctional Services, and we often come across inmates that are still idle and are not, have not just been receiving the required exercise. So I just want to know, really interesting to know if this has actually been dealt with sufficiently in facilities because it's not referred to. Number point six on page three, just with regard to the judicial inspector establishing its own domain email address that's distinct from the departments, I think that's a good move to look at what they call this percent independence. And under the issue of inspections, investigations, complaints, and mandatory reporting, just put to hear under 22 that baseline statistics are being finalized to measure the rate of change in compliance by the department in respect of the inspector's findings and recommendations, which is long overdue in trying to get that kind of measurement, and which would improve monitoring. I mean, just looking at, obviously it's concerning that there was also raised 50 reports of the use of force by officials and 47 deaths that arose from unnatural causes, which I will provide a little bit more detail as we go along. And point number four on page four, in the previous annual report was expressed around the possible misclassification of deaths in correctional sentence as natural rather than unnatural. According to this 2011-12 report, this concern remains and has not been addressed. It's also concerning that 12 women died of natural causes, 5 children and 2 infants. They found that in the report, the general has given reasons given for natural causes of death, but not specifically as to women, children, and infants. And it would be interesting to have that kind of classification, just to see if actually these vulnerable groups, what is actually causing their deaths. It was interesting to have the survey and ask the provisions, which was well overdue, and we really had encouraged that the judicial inspectorate will look at a more detailed study into the nature and extent of healthcare provisions, and this will take care of the next few years. So I think that really needs to be carefully monitored. With regard to point number seven, cooperation of DCS with the judicial inspectorate of correctional services was noted as good. But it was noted that the response time from area commissioners to regional commissioners was unreasonably long. And obviously the committee needs to monitor that, and it was recommended, there were recommendations made that the department at the regional level put in place more regulated policy that enjoins head and area commissioners to provide feedback within minimum periods. and it's implied that these delays impact negatively on communication, service delivery, and ultimately the treatment of inmates and conditions under which they are held. With regard to the first 792 children in our correctional facilities, it's another thing we should draw to the judge's attention as well. It is a great concern that 27% of unsentenced and 20% of sentenced children are held in relation to economic crimes. And we know that international South African law states that children under 18 should be in prison as a last resort. But it is very worrisome that we get children being held for those types of offenses. But I don't think any mention is made in terms of the way forward regarding that in the report. Further, point number 2 on page 4, the annual report talks about 51% of inmate population being detained for aggressive crimes, but it also talks about 33%, which is 52,194 for economic and drug-related crime. And I think it's always, time and time again, draws the committee's attention to the use of alternative sentences. And we really would like to know in our recommendations, we would really like to propose that one really looks at those inmates being held for under 24 months and those who committed economic crimes for either conversion to a non-custodial sentence, which obviously encourages the JCPS. I don't know how to encourage magistrates to consider alternatives. NICO's been running a pilot for non-custodial sentencing for 3 years now, and we find magistrates and the judiciary reluctant to use these options. And that remains a concern for us. Okay, with regard to another issue is point number 4 on page 5. We have stated that 79 remand detainees have been awaiting trial over 5 years, and that 2,470 remand detainees are being held for over 2 years. And I know now we've got legislation that looks at pre-trial after 2 years, it'd be monitored that people don't stay for over 2 years and that it goes to court. But I mean, obviously just to make a statement that this is still a very grave concern, that people have to wait for such a long time, and that every life that is damaged by incarceration is something we have to be concerned about. Okay, and there are some delays to the implementation of the law, and we'd really like to recommend that that be fast-tracked. Point number 6 is around the transferring of inmates. And I think NICO reports Jix's view that simply transferring inmates from overcrowded centres is not always a viable option. As besides inmates not receiving visits, smaller centres often experience shortages of special staff, etc., that hamper rehabilitation. And I think I refer to the Correctional Services Act that talks about transfers only happening. One needs to safeguard the fact that they need to be close as possible to their families. We've seen time and time again that evidence-based practice shows that in rehabilitation and effective reintegration, family visits are key. Particularly, NICO experiences this problem where families want to visit inmates that are in far off prisons and they don't have transport costs to get there, and this puts an extra burden on family, and it is an issue of concern. And we often have inmates not receiving visits for years and years, and this does affect their rehabilitation and eventual integration. So it's an area of concern. We know that the issues of overcrowding, seasonal programs and these, but I don't think these are always considered in terms of the legislation by the Department of Correctional Services. And I think that was evident in the complaints within this report. Okay, and we also support Dix's view that overcrowding must be used as a general justification for inadequate treatment or undignified conditions of detention. There could be some liability regarding that. Inspections and investigations. I'm just curious to know what criteria are used to do inspections. Is this just on a request basis, or I just found out it wasn't so clear in the annual report. We know the issues of staff shortages. I'm not going to go into that, but I think it's a grave issue, and the problems with contractors and the Department of Public Works. And the staff shortages, particularly of professionals in medical, social, and educational fields, it is also very concerning. But I think for us, particularly what's coming out with the Judicial Inspector's report, the Auditor General's report, is basically the absence of respect for the rule of law. within the Department of Correctional Services. It doesn't seem that regulations, policy, legislation is something that they consistently abide with, and I think that's an area that needs to be looked at. Okay, and also they mentioned issues of assaults on inmates and the issue of torture, and I think that's a international issue in terms of drawing attention to South Africa when it comes to a violation of human rights. And then lastly, I just want to look at complaints on page 7. 71% of inmates claim, okay, was on assault by officials. Okay, I think I mentioned the torture issue. Transfer issue I mentioned. I'm just trying to quickly see what's pertinent. The rest of the reports I'll just leave it to you. Parole, I think point number 3 on page 8, parole processes and releases being delayed as a result of inmates not completing certain programs on time is unacceptable. If there is a correctional sentence plan in place, the program should be completed well before the date for eligibility of parole arrives. If we find that inmates are obviously just before the date arrives or on the date, then they scramble around to get these programs done. And I don't think it's the inmate's duty to complete these programs. Who is the allocated case manager and who manages that sentence plan to make sure that these offenders don't have to, at the last moment, scramble to do these programs? So I think it's an area we need to look at. Legal representation complaints also remain extraordinarily high, but I see in the annual report no mention is mentioned of legal in South Africa, and we time and time again hear from inmates that that is an issue, and I think we very well know there's some issues related to that, but I didn't see that in the report. Okay, I think for now this point number 10 and number 9 is the last point I'd just like to make regarding unnatural death and the issue of suicide which happened during lockup. And once again, we'd like to raise the whole lockup issue, which is serious in terms of health care and death of inmates. Okay. Sorry for that's a price to transform the evidence if I could.
No, sorry for me, sorry for you. You have no time for the next one. I'm saying that how it works, basically. But let me just say this to our guests here. You're far too nice. You know, you're not going to have very many opportunities where you could stand here and really have a go at officials under the protection of the Portfolio Committee. You are very nice. I mean, Lucas, you probably went the furthest, but in a very mild way. I mean, what are we expecting you guys to do is to come here and say to us, the inspecting judge is failing. Because from 2009 until today, there's been so many deaths and yet nothing is happening. We really want to be as brutal as that, because when we talk to them tomorrow, we want them to understand the sentiment of the people on the ground. So I'm just saying you're very nice. If I was given that opportunity, I would lobby it as far as possible, because you're never going to have an opportunity to do this tomorrow, and we are hoping that we can be the conduit for your sentiments. But it's clear that civil society are worried about the sector since 2009. After so many deaths, there's nothing that is happening legally. Now, whether it's the prosecuting authority or whoever, nothing seems to be done. And then the legal inspecting judge has a role to play there. There's the whole issue around the effectiveness of the inspecting judge, and I'm going to put it cruder so that it puts a bit of emphasis. They feel that one inspector to 800 inmates is not effective. They can't do a proper job if there's one visitor to. And these are the things that we will raise. And they're really asking about the inspecting judge's real power. The real power that the inspecting judges have. If you are saying somebody must have an hour exercise, you see that he's not getting an hour exercise, what is it that you're doing about it? I think that's the kind of thing that's coming out. And those are the few that I've picked up. And I'm saying those are very straightforward. I want to summarize them so they don't even ask questions on those ones. So it's really about clarity so that we can be their voices tomorrow. But if there's anything else that you want to ask those men for clarity, let's raise it to them so that we can be in a position to argue their case tomorrow. Is there any clarity on Vanessa and Munching's input? We're not engaging with them on the context, but clarity so that we are able to articulate their views more clearly tomorrow. Advocate Max.
Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Mundi, with regard to your input, including it to the page 9, paragraph 23, you say the lack of prosecutors may indicate that these investigations are not thorough or not sufficient, independent, impartial. So are you actually saying, as a result of these shortcomings, it is an inference which one can draw from the situation? And secondly, that we see at the last three lines of the same paragraph, by virtue of the fact that there are less perpetrators if the employee of the DCS, that the pardon is implicated because the death of question indicates material failure on the part of the pardon to provide safe custody and then uphold the right of life. And you mentioned a couple of things prior to this paragraph. I had the pleasure to scrutinize also the union's input. Would you say that the lack of the department to provide safe custody for inmates is as a result of PSA input? Is it a result of a shortage of personnel or is it a lack of discipline? Thanks. That is for you and for Nicro.
Hold on, just to clarify. Okay. Your last point, are you saying it is a lack of human resources in the department or shortage in the... Because remember we're dealing with the...
Oh, yes, sorry, yeah.
The department will raise that later.
Okay, right.
We want to get enough ammunition to have a productive discussion with the inspector.
Okay, so then
for the department.
Okay, right. Then I go to the judge. Would you say that the department doesn't have sufficient resources, human resources, to investigate these shortcomings? And there's not a commitment, actually, from just to ensure there's a proper investigation and to push for a proper investigation outcome. Then for a clarity just on legal input with regards to children. My question is, in my view, there are children and children. Did you investigate the age group of these children when you report as a general referral? And the reason I'm asking it is that some children, yes, they are respectable. But there are those. There's no option. The court will fail the communities if they are being released outside. Because not even the parents can deal with it. So my question is, did you differentiate between age groups? Because those categories up to 18 and those younger than 18. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. And also thank you for the submission from Dr. Lucas and Nico. Chairperson, I think the submission of Dr. Lucas got the fact and a lot of questions need to be asked. We need to ask the department, not them. Then two, in terms of the Nico, also on the NICO check, whatever that is inside their document is also things that we are aware of it, that we need also to ask the department how far about those problems. But Chair, I wanted to add on NICO in terms of the programs. They don't say anything about themselves in terms of assisting the inmate or children that are out in our correctional center. That what programs do you have? Because as I have my constituents, in my constituents, you find that many people that are struggling in your offices, and I'm worried today because these are the taxpayers' money that we give NIPO. But we find that the community is not aware of their
their work in terms of assisting them on the family or inmate that is out from the center. How what is the problem that are on place in terms of you to assist the correctional service? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Jefferson. Advocate Mike, you asked about the inference that can be drawn, and I think if we look at what the inspectorate has put out in the public domain about unnatural deaths, where officials were implicated, and there are no prosecutions, I think it is highly unlikely that there can be virtually no prosecutions of officials in such a high number of unnatural deaths. But the problem is we don't know. We don't know why the DPP is not prosecuting. We don't know why investigations are being undermined and how they are being undermined. So, and that is what we're calling for. I think we need to open the door here and find out what is going on. That is the substance of our submission to committee on this. Now, the question about safe custody and whether it's sources of personnel and discipline and so on. In paragraph 21 of our submission, there's a basic summary of the pending deaths. And where prisoners were beaten to death, it was the result of punishments by a collective of officials who used the tonpas to beat people to death and then very often deny people medical attention when they hadn't died yet. So I think there's a very large proportion of, it goes beyond ill discipline, it claims brutality. In terms of investigations, I think the judicial inspectorate is in a situation where investigation similar to ICPIT does not currently fall within their mandate. We are asking that mandate be reviewed. On the other hand, the department has admitted to this committee last year, if my memory serves me correctly, that they have previously ignored the annual reports of the Judicial Inspectorate. So they have chosen not to act on what have been in general very good and solid recommendations. I think we really need to fight this battle on a couple of fronts to make sure that the oversight institution is also taken seriously by the department and that they are held accountable when they are not abiding and following by recommendations made by the inspectorate. Thank you, Jeff.
Just to answer Advocate Max's question, legislation says that all children under 18 should not be imprisoned. Imprisonment should be a last resort. And I think what my presentation focuses on, yes, I understand there are some children who are dangerous and more intensive rehabilitation needs to be done, but I think what I'm highlighting is that 27% of unsentenced and 26% of sentenced children are in there for economic crimes. And that should not be. I mean, these children can benefit from non-custodial options or even diversion options. So it's a concern for me, and even drug-related issues, that we still are seeing that in our prisons after the Child Justice Act has been implemented. So that was my issue. And then just to answer... regarding the issue about NICRO program, I think NICRO has been successfully diverting children, sometimes about 30,000 a year, very successfully, with a high success rate. We have a basket of programs. They go through proper assessment, thorough assessment, and we look at the needs of the child and within the context of the family and the community. There's from life skills programs to young violent offender programs to drug experimentation, drug addiction programs, community service, restorative justice interventions. I mean, we've successfully been dealing with children for the last, 15 years. So even before the Child Justice Act. And we've showed time and time again that diversion options and non-custodial options are working. And this is our concern. We're not talking about it just fishing it from the sky. We've done it ourselves. And that's why we know that there are other options and alternatives that can be used. We're not just suggesting it. We're also offering the service that is available in terms of alternatives. Yeah, so I hope that answers.
Even if it doesn't answer, it's fine. We will take it all and put it into our own pot as we prepare for tomorrow. Thank you very much. I'm now concluding that there are no more comments that relate directly to the report of the inspecting.
And also, Inspector Judge, you are free to leave if you want to, but you're more than welcome to stay and observe the views and the sentiments of Mhakathi generally. The tea and biscuits and those things seem to be available. I'm not sure Cindy is in charge. Can we give everybody 5 minutes and get back, or do people want to go as you talk? I'm just wondering about the... You want the 5 minutes, or do it working? All right. So people are free, we'll have a working tea. As long as you minimize the disruption, we will be happy. Can we then ask Mr. Yanni Oosthuizen and Mr. Piers Snyman from the Public Service Association of South Africa to do your presentation. Again, let me remind everybody, it's really about sharpening us for our interaction with the department. You're not going to have an opportunity every day to do it, but we would be able to do it for you. And you have total protection. Of course, you can't swear and beat somebody up, but other than that, you have total protection of expressing your views, and we will then carry them over tomorrow if we think that they're worth carrying over tomorrow and or Tuesday. Just to remind, I think it was Ms. Fariyaki or somebody, indeed we are having a discussion on the independence and or strengthening the inspecting judge around about the 30th of October. So those of you that feel that there's a need to contribute to that discussion, the date is the 30th of October, and we will take it further. Does he need more power? Doesn't he need power? All those discussions. It's the 30th, isn't it? 31st, I beg your pardon. 31st of October, we'll have that discussion. Meneer Orna,
Ida. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My colleagues, Jan Oosthuizen, just want to introduce them, and Mr. Ali Musetic from the labor relations component in the PSA. Honorable Chairperson, what we have done, we have looked at the report, studied and zoomed in into matters that relate to our core business. Now, our core business is to protect the rights and interests of the employees of the department. Just as an introduction, Chairperson, the Honourable Committee members are familiar with the PSA. We have engagements throughout the year. For the rest of Africa, the Public Service Association is a registered trade union, Chairperson. It's the biggest non-political aligned union in South Africa. And we negotiate in all spheres of government, the negotiating council and chambers, and we are proud to say, Honourable Chair, that we have obtained a 51% majority status in the General Public Service Sectoral Bargaining Council, and Correctional Services is a chamber that falls under the GPSSBC. Chairperson, as I have indicated, we have zoomed in and on the matter that is really affecting our members, and We first want to deal with the overcrowding and shortage of staff in prisons. The prison, it's common knowledge that prisons were built by the majority of the prisons were built really by the apartheid government for penal institutions and not really for purposes of rehabilitation. It makes the conditions, the working environment just a bit difficult if your structure is not built for the purpose of rehabilitation. Chairperson, taking into consideration the establishment of the department, we've noted in the report that there were 47,336 posts, but only 41,500 funded posts. Now, Chairperson, 47 was funded before 2010. But then Treasury allegedly have indicated that the department must do some cost-cutting measures. And the easy way out was to cut post-establishment. Now, taking that in consideration, in this committee, in February, the department reported that it needs 18,000 new posts in order for the seven-day establishment to work. Now, if I do that calculation, it came to almost 58,000, 59,000 posts. We are at 41,500. Now, for how long is this going to continue, Chairperson? The department needs to appoint employees. It needs to grow the establishment of the department in order for employees to do their job. It cannot be expected for the core business in the department, those employees working with the core business, security and rehabilitation, to do two employees' work. One employee must do two employees' work. Because in the 41,500 posts, there's also support staff included in there. The administrative chairperson. So we really need to look into that. The overcrowding chairperson is really a concern. And for how long is correctional officials going to work in an environment where overcrowding reaches levels of 160%? Like, for instance, at Grootvlei, it continuously stays there. Also, sometimes in certain centers, it's reported 180%. Now, for employees to work in that conditions, chairperson, it's just unacceptable. Then we must also look, chairperson, what is the union doing and what we have done? We went to the chamber, and we said, oh, if the stats show that overcrowding is going to be persistent there, we need to find some way of relief and negotiate a circumstantial allowance. The status employer in the council has turned their back on this, and indicating that they're not going to enter into negotiations into this matter of a circumstantial allowance. Chairperson, this forces us, again, to take a legal avenue. And what we are planning to do, if the employer is not going to enter into negotiations, is to go to the court and say, well, our employees have the right to a safe working condition, a working environment. Then the court must rule what overcrowding statistic will be safe. We ask you to interrogate the department regarding that matter. Chairperson, the one flows to the other in this report as we have zoomed into the issues. Overcrowding, shortage of staff, grievances and sick leave. Chairperson, in no less than two presentations in this year, we have raised concern in this committee saying that we as the union experience a high level of temporary incapacity leave, sick leave, in this department, disputes about that. And it's now confirmed in the report that our report, the position which we have made known to this committee, is true, Chairperson. On page 36 of the annual report, it states that till in DC it was benchmarked against police, justice and constitutional development, and Department of Defense. The result, Chairperson, of the exercise indicated DCS are the leading department when it comes to sick leave. The department, what is astonishing for us, Chairperson and committee members, is that the department is giving a reason in the report saying it abuses of sick leave. Our Chairperson, the PFA, our core business is to protect the rights and interests of those employees. We took it on arbitration when it was declined. And Chairperson, we have a lot of success when it comes to temporary incapacity disputes of the department. Arbitrators is not ruling, Chairperson, to say, well, I'm going to award you compensation or grant you sick leave as an arbitrator when you offer a reason of abuse. It must be a valid reason. So, Chairperson, it's not abuse, but if you look at the working environment, the shortage of staff, the overcrowding, obviously that will flow to more sick, to the increase in sick leave. It's because of the working conditions and the understaffing of prisons. Chairperson, when one looks at the grievances, it's a report in this report that during 2010 and 2011, 771 grievances were recorded. In this year report, it almost doubled. Employees that is unsatisfied, that are aggrieved with the department, with the employer, have doubled their person almost to 1,382.
the explanation by the employer, by correctional services. Chairperson, the explanation is that they are saying that employees allege unfair labor practices and poor staff morale as reasons for the drastic increase in the grievances. While we agree as PSOs that the staff morale is very low, and we have reported to this committee on numerous occasions in this year, Honorable Chairperson, that there are so many court cases pending which relates to the conditions, one, and secondly to the income of correctional officials. Now, when you struggle for 2 years in court, morale cannot be good when the result of that court case will have a direct impact on the employee's salary and its working time. So really, it's time we are pleading with the portfolio committee. When are the department going to end this court cases? When are they going to stop the review court cases? Arbitration awards when it comes to our employees, people that need to provide for their families in the communities. They just take everything on review. Suspensions. We are really concerned, members of the committee, about the number of employees who have been suspended in this financial year. If you do the calculation, and in the report, it amounts to 45,910 days. And it cost the state 15,678,000. Now, Chairperson, we are, as PSA, in a position to comment on that because we represent those members in the disciplinary matters. So we know what's happening there. We don't have to draw an inference. Well, our members are reporting. We, on a daily basis, ask the department to review the suspension one, to promptly institute disciplinary action. The reason, Chairperson, what we at PSA is saying, why there is so many suspensions, is inadequate management of discipline, first. And secondly, the number of days, if one calculates that, it's because the employer is inadequate when dealing with the disciplinary processes. There's clear indications in collective agreements governing discipline to say it must be taken prompt, institute prompt, and finalized promptly. But there's cases that drag out for months and even years. For years, Chairperson, and those persons are on suspension. It's actually costing the taxpayer, and it puts also unnecessary stress, one, on the employees who is remaining because there's a shortage there, because of the suspension within the prison, and secondly, it also has an influence on the family of such an employee if he's suspended, if dad does not go to work. Artisans and production levels, Chairperson, is clear in the report. Only 64.2% of the production target was met when it comes to the production of vegetables. The reasons for underperforming with regards to the vegetable totals are shown. The PSA, however, wants to highlight the most significant reason for underproduction, which according to our members is because of the new shift system that resulted in a shortage of staff, and that led the agriculture component suffering the most. It seems that gone are the days where prison farms flourished to the extent of producing crops for almost the entire prison population. For us, it remains an open question whether the employer gave consideration to buying more food because of the expected drop in producing of vegetables because of the new 7-day establishment. Chairperson, and then just a general remark, a general observation. We continuously visiting our present facilities as leadership of the union and also our senior shop stewards. Chairperson, and it's really, it was not actually in the report, so I'm just saying that it's a general observation for us in this period after the report, is that when one is visiting this premise, it seems to that it's worsening, it's dilapidated, person. It not neat as it were was in the past. And that also reflects on the morale when you go to your institution as an employee where you work, and your place is untidy, it's not neat. So we're really asking the portfolio committee to engage the department really to look after the premises. And for us again, it's a simple reason, it's a shortage of staff. When there's not enough staff, you pipe on your agriculture and your working things outside. That means all those prisoners that allocated to work teams, to the working teams, must stay inside. It's a slow open to more opportunity for gangsterism and gangster activities. Chairperson, in conclusion, really, we're doing our best at the PSA to motivate a staff force that is where the morale is really low. Currently in correctional services, we really try to motivate them. And then, Chairperson, thank you to the management of correctional services, but today we really want also to thank the correctional officers outside that are really doing the job. There are, if you look at the staffing totals, they are doing more than one man, and we want to thank them for that. And I think South Africa must also thank them for that. Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members.
Thank you so much. Sir, we'll take the pop crew presentation, and then we'll open up for questions from members, then it deals with both labor unions. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Kalina Pambi. Honorable Chair and portfolio members of the Portfolio Committee and all the stakeholders, it is an honor indeed for us to make this presentation. We want to zoom directly to a number of focus areas, starting with the administration. Chairperson, we have noted that the effectiveness of anti-corruption, as per the report, we hope it's true, under continuous assessment and hoping that the department will develop more effective mechanisms to prevent maladministration and corruption. We furthermore remind the department that quality service delivery is largely dependent on having the right people in the right places. With competencies and skills that corresponds with the scope of the operation. As these, which is maladministration, corruption and fraud, are still noted as serious challenges within the department, as proven by the reported cases, both pending and completed. The fact that governance in the department has been affected by several suspensions of officials is a disturbing factor. And our submission is that the department should uphold transparency principle, that is, according to policies that continue to drive our government. This we must do in addition to our other strategic mechanisms, like whistleblowing, as well as other judiciary processes. We have learned that combating corruption remains a major challenge within the department, thereby, therefore, a need for a more systematic and partnership approach. Honorable Chair, the report clearly indicates that there's a proposed structure which is clearly aligned to the functions of the DCS. We want to amend our submission on this one, which said POPRU hopes this structure will indeed serve the right position is that POPRU, as an organization, we say this structure will not serve a good purpose to the department as compared, because it's not as good as the current one, or what is the amendment. So the top-heavy JoJo structure is the same as what is now proposed as a new structure. The interest of the staff establishment at the central level must be a key feature of the correctional services medium-term planning, with the emphasis on recruiting quality above quality and ensuring the effective discipline skill development of recruits in line with the CS's responsibilities and priorities. Increases to the staff establishment will allow for the enhanced implementation of the department's mandate. A flatter organizational structure is therefore required for better service delivery to these South African citizens rather than the many layers of command and control currently in existence and which is contained in the so-called new structure. Restructuring the service is necessary as a way forward to better rehabilitation and integration of offenders. The revised structure should incorporate the advantages of decentralization of work and authority along with the specialized skills that will be available at the central level, not what has happened in past years, which was a waste of funds, as we repeatedly indicated to this committee. In fact, our position is that in fact, there's more manpower in the department, as you said, so in fact, it is purely utilized in the top, duplication of functions, unnecessary pushing of papers, the same jobs. Now the proper restructuring and alignment of the structure might alleviate what it's currently contained about the shortage of membership on the ground while looking for funds for future employment. On the security, we have noted the decline of staff for assaults with understanding that a great percentage is inmates on inmates. The report on assault is of great concern to us due to the fact that if the department does not put more effort in ensuring a zero tolerance on assault, this might impact negatively towards our members, as inmates might assault them due to their frustration and overcrowding, which is still a huge challenge for the department. We as a result, urge the department to treat this matter with sensitivity, as we believe that working environment plays a pivotal role in the effective delivery of any employee. If our members continue to work under unsecured conditions, that is the case now, they might be demoralized, as they are demoralized, and this might lead to poor service delivery by the department. On the other hand, we are concerned with the stats of unnatural deaths as reported on the current and previous financial years. The department indeed did a sterling work in ensuring correction centers are not turned into mortuaries. We furthermore submit that the department should accelerate the acquisition of its integrated security technology to help the otherwise obvious high figures of escapes, and the provision of safe and secure correctional facilities is a fundamental responsibility of the department. We applaud the implementation of the gang management unit. Hope it will be effective. Coming to corrections, we welcome the endorsement of two new correctional programs provided to address theft and fraud related offenses and further encourage the department to improve on the percentage of eligible offenders with more opportunities, as this will play a crucial role in curbing recidivism. In simple terms, the department should fill in all vacant funded positions that will play a crucial role in developing inmates instead of reporting the targets were not met due to shortage of staff. There are vacant positions which will take. It doesn't need so much to fill those positions. It's just the willingness. It's obvious that it's an obvious fact that this is a critical program that put both inmates and officers' health at risk due to communicable diseases that might spread across the board if not well managed. It's therefore utmost importance that the department maintains and where possible upgrade the highest level of medical care and treatment. We are fair of the view that the department should be more sensitive with regard to inmates who have been diagnosed with mental illness, as they might pose a serious danger to the officers. And over and above, the department should explore other alternatives for this means, as they obviously can't be properly rehabilitated with their state of mind. On this program, we would like to urge the department to consider the submission we presented during 2010-11 annual report that recommended the department to attract and retain skills, the doctors, psychologists, and so forth, that are required to effectively assist in the delivery of adequate care programs within the facilities. On development, we find it very disturbing that the overall participation of offenders in various skills development programs could not be reached due to shortage of technical educators, artisans, and other professionals for the provision of the skills development programs. We made several presentations on filling of skill positions, as we did now. Therefore, reports that this nature indicates that input rates in these sittings at times or raised to the department are not really taken into cognizance. The report under review states that the department succeeded in exceeding the target of filling 1.4 vacancies set as a target for 2011-12 financial year, but they still remain a challenge at the center level in terms of service delivery. Honourable Chair, it should be borne in mind that the effectiveness of the organizational structure should not be drawn directly to the numbers employed, but rather the caliber of such. Therefore, it is the wasteful expenditure if indeed resources would be channeled to feed a certain section of the department, whereas the other, which is a critical component, surpassed to effectively deliver those services. Chair, regardless of the input presented last year on staff development, this report still does not reflect any progress made on such, and this time around we would like the department to provide us with an explanation towards this concern. Does this mean the department does not develop its employees? We would like to see the department providing skills development to the officials in order for it to render effective service delivery. We are therefore requesting a report in this manner. We are of the view that employees are the engine in achieving great objectives of this department, and it's therefore essential that it must be regarded and treated as such. If the department intends or wants to succeed, it should develop those skills and competencies of its employees. This is also informed by the fact that the department is going through alterations, and it's unimaginable how officials can deliver on the mandate if there is no training that cuts across that is being provided. The challenges experienced by the department have to be met and addressed with the limited financial muscles at our disposal, and that requires all of us to be meticulous in our efforts of promoting the spirit of the white paper. The social integration. Chairperson, the research has proven that the period after release is extremely important in reducing the chances of the proverbial revolving door of free offending, with particular emphasis on parole and correctional supervision. Yet, the social reintegration program receives about 5% of the total budget. It's our view that the strategic plan is silent in as far as addressing the needs of released prisoners through access to services and continuing education. Well, we view it as important that the department, in as far as there is in prison services, it should extend these to include post-release. We believe that there's a great impact of prison reintegration into communities, and unless more funds are allocated and the concept of social reintegration is hypothesized, we risk the real possibility of the revolving law. This new chair is informed by the fact that the white paper corrections is expressive about the focal point or role of the family, community, and the society at large, and the role of the rehabilitation and social integration of the offender. We are pleased to here that submissions of community members on parole hearings are showing a marked increase with the start of 250B in 2010-2011, rising to 684 in 2011-2012. Though there is still a question of implementation on various inputs presented to this committee. We are ever encouraged that we encourage the department to work closely with some progressive NGOs that have a better link with communities that the parolees are going to be released into. This view is heightened by the increasing evidence that certain communities contribute largely to the prison population, and as a result, community life becomes destabilized in many ways. This, of course, has led to young people going through the system on a continuing basis. The second program is facilities. The 2012-13 strategic plan articulates the strategy of reducing overcrowding in the facilities through the reduction of the length of detention of remand detainees and improved management of conversion of custodial sentence. Yet, it's with regret to note that some particular program is not well managed. Our contention is that the department has continuously allocated funds for the past financial years to the so-called PPPs without a concrete and permanent solution to our challenge, current challenge. In 2009-10, 728 million. 2010-2011, 771. And this current year, 774 million. This represents a marked increase of 7% in the current year. And this is a significant intentional diversion of funds to feed the public, the private prisons. May I remind this house that the government of South Africa adopted a policy known as what would be the principle, which is guiding documents predominantly used to guide departments on our issues of service delivery and utilization of public funds. It's therefore our view that this policy document is being violated by the department, whereby the funds allocated to ensure proper implementation of the department's mandate are being redirected to render department useless. Honorable Chair, it's our considered view that the department does not comply fully with the requirements of Section 35 of the Constitution with respect to the conditions of detention that are consistent with human dignity. The Correctional Services Act, Chapter 3, brings these rights into operation and compliance with this requirement should be the ultimate focus, considering the funds that are at the disposal of the department should make this program a possibility. Chair and the House of Branch, we are further concerned by a report that even this year we are confronted with the reality of two centers, which is Ceres and Van Rensdorp, that are still incomplete, and this is perhaps compounded by the fact that this project were allocated to a single service provider, perhaps without even the necessary capacity. And Chair, moving forward, we request that the department to thoroughly intervene and provide the much-needed intervention in this project, as situations of this nature contribute further to the glut of challenges experienced by the department. And in this regard, Chair, there are services within the department. We had the building groups within the department. We had all manner of teams that were specializing in, I think PSA referred to that, on agriculture and other fields of industry, which have been swept away. But it's not because of lack of membership, obviously. It's because of now privatization and outsourcing. And if that can be brought back, it will accelerate the issue of rehabilitation whilst discharging the mandate of the department on the other side. In conclusion, Chair, we'd like to thank all the correctional officials who continue to do work with dedication and commitment under life-threatening conditions. To all our members, we continue to expect vigilance, discipline, and professionalism.
And the last part, which the on page 28 of this report, it is said that all issues of the OSD have been completed and implemented, and that's not the true reflection, and the department knows that. Thank you.
Questions of clarity, if any, to further empower us in our discussion tomorrow, Mam Gwania, and then Advocate Max.
Thank you, Chairperson. Also for the submission. Chairperson, the presentation, I will refer to the same presenters that have sending to us that most of the questions that need to be asked is on the department that we need to ask, because they are referring also in the report that maybe we're just getting report today, and I think that also we've got questions that we need to ask the department on what is in the report. But I want to ask you from POPCO in terms of the members that are sick than everyone in this department that we are having. And Chair, I'm worried because we are asking this since 2009. I want to know from the corporate, what are they doing to assist in terms of this sick leave as well as my members? We understand Bangaba says, and maybe the issue of the overtime is the one that makes them sick like this, that they can get money. Really, I'm worried, Chair, people who get sick twice a month. It's only department, just the report here. I don't want to go through only, but it's true that they get sick like them, everyone in the department that we're having. So as a union, I want to know with Nezan Bowling Island, Java Seven Zabakula Ranga. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, you know, you said earlier on that those presenters here of the reports are very mild. You were just, and you know, and I fall in that category. I was for the past 2 years very mild towards DCS. What POPCRU and PSA actually present to us here is what they did for the past 2 years. And it is consistent with the AG's findings as well. You know, if my son tells me tomorrow that Dad, I want to join DCS, I would disown him while the current management is there. There's one department don't give a damn for his staff. And that is what we experience at Central Level. I just want to say it is like my responsibility to serve and provide for my children, and once they ask me for food, I said let us first arbitrate before I buy food. Arbitrate that thing. That is how DCS is dealing with their personnel. PSA. Having regard to your input, on page, what is your page? Your pages are not numbered. But it's just about suspensions. Do you express you correctly when you say, at the second paragraph, the employer claims alleged unfair labor practice and poor staff morale as reason for the drastic increase in grievances? Is it what the department said? Because if it is unfair labor practice, obviously the employee themselves is responsible for that particular problem there, in my view. And secondly, under suspension, you say the employer did not institute disciplinary proceeding timely. Is there not a particular policy after suspension within, like a collective agreement or a resolution, which states that within 6 days, like the test,
After the suspension, within 6 days, your disciplinary hearing must be finalized. He says, if so, then there's obviously a contravention of that particular agreement. And you claim further on, 440 employees were suspended to return to work after finalization of the disciplinary process. Is that now after the hearing, or was these suspensions uplifted before hearing and after investigation, and they find that no substantial failure to proceed with this particular disciplinary investigation? Then, what is your view with regard, you talk about farming and producing of crops and so forth. No. Pokru also, I was going to ask Pokru as well. What is your view with regards to, just to only your view, with regards to the outsourcing of the teachers? Then to Pokru, you didn't mention anything about, let me finish with the, with PSA with regards to your grievances, and you indicated with the page now, it was double the amount of grievances launched. Is that the result of these arbitrations, that management decisions need to be implemented, management, that members have to embark on grievance procedures to get a simple management decision of what do you think is the cause of these grievances? And POP Group, your OSD, recently POP Group was awarded an award by a arbitration award around the OSD about students, a second group of students who are eligible for this remuneration. What is the fact? What is the start of that particular thing? And also your view on the kitchen story, the outsourcing of kitchens. It's another point I would like to make. You mentioned on page 6, the first paragraph, the last sentence. Officials cannot deliver the mandate on the mandate if there is no training that cuts across that is being provided. What training are you referring to? Then your remark on page 5 of group under program 5, your first paragraph, last sentence. Inputs raised in this setting are not taken into consideration. Are you saying, or are you implying that after these numerous occasions with you came to this portfolio committee complaining about the same issues and there's no change that even the portfolio committee does not have any effect on the DCS management attitude to change things? Is what you are saying to us. And the unnatural death of page 4. You refer to unnatural death, page 4. And you can have concern about it. But at the same time, you say they are doing a certain job not to allow the center to go to turn into mortgages. What is, because you as a union, your members are working in these facilities. What is your own finding? What is the real issues here and what is the reasons according to your investigation, if you conducted any, why this non-prosecution act alluded to by the previous Dr. Hutton, previous speakers? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, because you already noted me, I want to raise the point of order. But because you already noted me, then I felt that, no, let me start.
to correct the house. I don't think whatsoever here present about the issue of outsourcing. So, Chairperson, let us rule this matter of outsourcing out, because really we still have to discuss this matter in the comment section. So, really, I don't think they raise it, neither Pope Crew or...
Stop having your own internal fight. Raise your point.
Neither Pope Crew and PCA. And another thing, Chairperson, we are not here to score a political point. We are here listening to them, to what they are giving to us. And then they just armed us so that when we are with the department, we knew very well what is happening there. So we trust them when they hear with that regard. Really, we are not here to cross-question them, because once they can start it, really, they must tell us the whole story. So really, the union will be surprised that they can know the reality of the department. Then it will be, really, if they can have that, Chairperson, we'll come to debate it. So I think maybe you have to, Chairperson, to calm that situation and focus in these matters. Chairperson, there is only one thing that I want to ask to the PSA. There's a self-simple, if they, on their observation, lastly, it is in the read that document, but it's on our observation, the centers are not like before. In terms of the cleanliness. So my question just to that audio observation, because really we are dealing with the department here, and also the workers are working for the department. He even said that before. First, I want him just to clarify before statement why is before. And then what is wrong now? And then what if it said before, really must mention that before maybe in the apartheid government or before, or what before is what I really want. And then also, as the PSA, they are the union of the workers, they go there, they say they used to visit. I want to know that they visit, and then you find that they even spoke about it in their people, the people that have laid to them as the union, that look, where we are working is not good. Sometimes because you find that there are people who are employed to do that, and maybe they are always putting the leave form, and then it's not there, and then in the end of the day, that person end up not doing this shoot. But I'm interested about the before thing, I think.
I want to talk to members first, and then I'll come to you. When I started, I did indicate that it's a rare opportunity that civil society can come and talk to us. I don't think we must be careful that we should not intimidate civil society to such a point that they don't want to talk to us because they are shy. I'm just saying we must be careful about that. I mean, you know, if you told me that I'm ugly, sir, I should be able to accept it because I've asked for that input. Now, how I deal with it going forward is something else. I thought it's appealing with us. Because remember, they're really giving us, we're supposed to work this thing and we take it somewhere else. So I don't want people to that when going back to those committees, because when we give our input, we get interrogated. And I'm not saying you're doing that. I'm just warning us against that one. And I'm also saying to you that as far as is possible, I'll try and defend you. But obviously, if you're going to be saying things that will intimidate other human beings, then maybe on your own. But I will try and defend you. I really do think that you guys should be able to speak your heart. Whether I like it or not is a different story. If I've invited you, I should have put you an opportunity to say that I'm ugly, if you think so. Without being threatened that when you walk out and say you'll be beaten up. So I just thought that we clear that so that you know us and them type of tension. Tomorrow and Tuesday the tensions will be there and I'll encourage it. But today, we're all on the same side. We're all family.
Can we ask you guys 3 minutes, 3 minutes, because time is really going to catch up. I know there were many, many questions asked. If you guys could try and cluster some of these questions. If you don't answer all of them, fine. Otherwise, time is really going to get to us. If you could answer as many as you can, sir, and then Nazi as many as you can, and hopefully it will capture what members would want from a clarity point of view. Meneer Pornaita.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I will start responding to the question of Mr. Magangula, the Honourable Member. I'm referring in my presentation indicating an observation and emphasis from the Honourable Member on reform. I must indicate that I have omitted in the report to say before the time of this report, meaning that a year or two ago, there is a deep-related of premises in our observation. Also, the member, Honourable Member, indicated that we as union are visiting there. Do we also speak to our members, because some of our members are assigned to look after the premises? Just to indicate, I'm going to be very frank in answering this, to say I personally visited a prison some 2 months ago. It was untidy, the glass was high, and I asked, but what's happening here, comrades? What's happening? This place is untidy. And their response was, there's no money for petrol to cut the grass. So it's not that the member is of sick. It's just there is no tools and petrol to keep the place tidy. Honourable Max referred to the grievances. He has heard that it's doubled. And what is our view as to the reasons? Honourable Member, I think there is almost double grievances because of the non-implementation of certain OSDs. It's when specifically referring to specialized groups such as educators, where the extension of the resolution was approved but is not yet implemented. And also to go on to that question, grievances comes before arbitration. So next year in the report you might see double arbitrations, because if a grievance is not resolved, it goes to the level of arbitration. Farming and vegetables, there was a reference to what our position of the outsourcing of kitchens, and Honourable Member Magangula have asked there for your intervention as chair. But I'm just going to answer that the PSA is totally against privatization. We think that prisoners must be skilled or learn skills such as in the kitchens, and they must get that from our core, one of our core responsibilities, and that is rehabilitation and training. And also it opens a gap where prisoners can interact with private companies, private people that don't know security measures, as in the case of correctional officials. In terms of the suspensions, the collective agreement, like in the SAPS, yes, of course there's a resolution, one of 2006, that is governing discipline in the Department of Correctional Services. Preferable not a suspension not longer than 30 days, but that you don't get in correctional services. You will notice in correctional services that there's a delay in institute proceedings and then a further delay in terms of the proceedings that end up in a huge delay and where members are suspended. That also can indicate that from my personal experience working with some suspended members is that that's also a reason for the increase in grievances, because after 30 days you advise your member to put in a grievance because the suspension is not uplifted or the process is not instituted, and then you go to the arbitration route. So yes, Honourable Max, there is a resolution governing that. If it has adhered to, that is a different
ball game. It's not adhered to. Chairperson, I think I have covered more or less all of the aspects. How do we calculate it? Sorry, how did we come to the calculation of 441 people that be suspended but not dismissed? If one look at page 183 of the report, it will indicate how many people were really dismissed, and it's 119 in this financial year. And if you look at page 57, you will see that 532 were suspended. So if you do the calculation, and they might be up and down, but at average you can say around about then 440 people were suspended, but at the end of the day was not fired or dismissed from correctional services. So the question was really, was there a reason, a real reason to suspend for such a long period of time that ended up costing the taxpayer 15 million rand? Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Yes, thank you. I'll be 1 minute. What are we doing about the six members continuously? Oh, well, I think that should be, that question in fact should be directed to the department. What is it doing about? Obviously, the department must find out what are the facts which lead to continuous sick members taking sick leave. Well, as we did at the tail end of our presentation, we are encouraging our members to do their utmost best in terms of executing their functions under this tremendously difficult situation. We continue to do that. The OSD outcome, as is the practice in the department, it is taken up on review. To delay, obviously it will take a couple of years if it's not, for obvious reasons, delay. Training, previously there has been in-house training. It's just for department now to do with the issues of accreditation and so on and so on. The way there are basic training, for example, you work in a reception, in a parole board, in the all these areas, the administration part, which has been a course. We're talking about something like that. There is a course at management level, which was done by the University of UCT, I think, for managers. And others, I mean, to upskill the officials. That is the training that we are talking about. Infiltrate not taken, indeed, yes. We have taken, I think, for as long as one came to the next presentation here, we spoke about the top heavy structure. I don't know how many it is back, but the top heavy structure, it is still there today. It is just given another name now. So it's still there. You can count many others. Vacant positions are still vacant, as we speak, majority of them. So it's happening. Outsourcing of kitchens, yes, indeed, we'll make a comment. Indeed, it's not a viable option to consider. In fact, even the outsourced kitchen management now is done by the inmates. So it's just waste of resources. The tender premier that is taking place, that's money. Taking the government's money for nothing. The in-house arrangement is well good. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. We're taking your point. Just from you, sir, you mentioned earlier on, and I'm raising it now, because you sort of intimated that Treasury said cut costs and not necessarily cut staff. Did I understand you correctly? And then what the department did is to cut staff numbers because it was the easiest way of cutting costs. Is that how you understand it? So the fact that we had it fine. No time, because we can then raise it tomorrow. Because our understanding of the 41 to 45 was a direct instruction from Treasury to cut heads. You are saying it's not necessarily cut heads, it was cut costs, and then they thought that the heads were the easy way to go. That was the understanding of it. By then, can we then go in the following order? Just detention, because you have not spoken at all. Yeah, once again, if you're done, you can leave. Just detention, then the Institute of Security Studies, and then we will go to Nicro and
civil society, because you've had the first cut, just to give everybody else a cut, and by then we'll have cut everybody. It is to 5. I know we're scheduled to finish at 5. Can we agree that at the absolute latest at 5:30 we're out of here? We're asking people to be very brief. We're also asking members to be very brief, because it's really about empowering us for tomorrow. So can we then ask Emily to take us through your presentation, Emily, and after Emily, we will then ask Hamad Zirifi, are you here? Is that? Hey? Oh, you are. You do it immediately after, and then we will have that discussion, and then we'll take that issue. Okay, so after you, you'll follow. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you very much. My name is Emily Keen. I'm from Songke Gender Justice. I'm here representing a partnership between Songke and Just Detention International. We're working together to end sexual abuse at DCF facilities and promote inmates' right to health, particularly focusing on HIV. Our submission focuses solely on parts of the annual report that deal with these two issues. We're concerned about both sentenced and remand inmates, and we that health and safety are prerequisites to any rehabilitation that can take place and are core to DCF's mission. And we believe that the annual report shows that DGS is in fact not giving sufficient attention to the health and safety of inmates. Starting with sexual abuse, the DCF report on key policy developments, including the Correctional Matters Amendment Act that was enacted last year, but it makes no mention of its amendments of Section 38 of the Correctional Services Act, which requires newly sentenced inmates to be screened for vulnerability to sexual abuse. These are some of the things I've raised a couple in various submissions, so you're familiar with it, but I just want to highlight it here again because there's been no progress reported on this in the annual reports. We made numerous inquiries to the head office regarding this through various avenues and received no response. Also offered our support to develop the screening tool, which will need to be developed in order to implement the amendment, and received no response. This amendment enacts a key portion of the policy framework to address sexual abuse of inmates, which was completed almost 2 years ago and has yet to be adopted. That was drafted, the drafting of that framework started in 2008. It was a long and arduous process. DCF head audits was putting a lot of effort into that, working collaboratively with civil society. It was completed in December 2010, and again, no adoption, numerous inquiries, and no response at all from the head audit. So we're urging your support to pressure on the department to adopt that. And the last thing I heard was that it reached the previous minister's desk for authorization, but after the reshuffle, it's been lost again, and I have received no response from the new minister regarding this. We noted a slight increase in assaults, which is, of course, concerning. I just want to highlight there's really not enough information regarding the assaults in the report to be really useful. Of the alleged assaults, 70% were staff on inmates. We don't know how many of those alleged faults were confirmed. The report said that 238 disciplinary actions were instituted concerning assault and attempted assault. But if you take 70% of all the cases, that's almost 900 cases of staff on inmate assaults. So without knowing how many are confirmed, this is not very useful to measure the department's response to this. But looking at what Dix has reported on, they received complaints about staff on inmate assault, which is about 71. They did their own legal analysis and found that 8 of those were prima facie cases of torture under the Prevention and Combating of Torture Bill. And despite that, only 1 of those complaints resulted in a disciplinary action. So obviously you can kind of infer what's going on there. Assaults reported are not slowing down to reflect those that are sexual in nature. This is despite assurances from the head office and various people at local levels that this is now being implemented, and those statistics are being gathered separately. It's really important that these are disaggregated for public consumption. The DDS is not doing this. I just want to highlight Dix is also not reporting on this separately, and we urge both to do that. Dix has reported on it previously at the survey they conducted in 2007-2008, but it's not something that's regularly done. We noted that the training that's reported on does not focus on conflict resolution skills, violence prevention, or dealing with sexual abuse despite the ongoing high levels of assault, so that's obviously a problem. The gang management strategy is obviously a welcome development, but there's really not enough information to understand what's in that strategy, how it's being implemented, whether it's even being implemented at the local level. So it's not that useful in the way it's been reported. As we all know, sexual abuse in ECS centers is very much linked to gang culture. So we're interested to know if that gang management strategy includes methods to address sexual abuse as perpetrated by gangs, because it should do this. The shift system in lockups, as others have noted, is still an ongoing concern. The staffing crisis means there's creeping monitoring, especially at night and weekends. This is when a lot of sexual abuse and other forms of violence take place. Discussions about how to address the violence that's taking place, not necessarily put changing the lockup procedure on the table as part of the solution or the discussion. So we want to urge the committee to put that on the table with departments. And also for organized labor, even though they've left now, to consider to put lockup, changing the lockup process on the table as part of their discussions with departments, management, in terms of addressing shifts, the seven-day establishment, and so on. Concerning HIV and AIDS, we noted and I guess congratulate the department on an increase in the number of inmates who have been tested for HIV. It went from 19% to 42% this year. It's a jump up, but it's obviously not good enough. And again, the information in the report is really lacking. We don't know the number of inmates who are HIV positive. There's really no reliable prevalence data on this. The DCF Commission's study for 2007 found 19.8% of inmates had HIV, but that wasn't reliable data because it didn't include in its sample population any of the remand detainees. That's about 30% of the population, so obviously it's not reliable to go off of that number. But if we use that number, we know there's at least 30,000 inmates who are HIV positive. So if only 42% are being tested, it's not really sufficient. Also, what's just reported in terms of screening new inmates upon admission, medical assessments upon admission, is also concerning. It noted only that 38% of inmates surveyed did not get assessed upon admission. 54% did not receive immediate treatment for ailments that they presented. And very worryingly, 9% of centers that he surveyed did not have any doctors visit in the last 3 months. So DCF obviously does not have a clear picture of what's going on and cannot address these health challenges. Treatment levels for HIV-positive inmates is also critically low and is especially concerning considering the high levels of HIV-related deaths that are taking place. 40% of eligible HIV-positive inmates are receiving antiretroviral treatment. That's not enough. 69% who have CD4 counts below 350, and again, the CD4 count is a measure of immune system's health. Only 69% of them are on antiretroviral treatment. For us, we're not really sure how DCS, what the DCS's policy is in terms of who's eligible and who's not eligible and whether it's in line with the Department of Health policy. But the way it's reported looks like it's not necessarily in line with that. And that's not necessarily a problem if it's kind of erring on the side of caution, but we're not sure. So if the DCS is saying HIV-positive inmates with CD4 counts below 350 are immediately eligible, we would welcome that kind of policy, but we don't know. So we need your help to get clarification on that. Again, HIV and AIDS is one of the leading causes of natural death, as reported by CHICS. TB is the leading cause of death, and that's a common opportunistic infection for people who are HIV-positive. The lack of treatment is obviously contributing to the number of natural deaths that are happening. Antiretroviral treatments can greatly reduce the chance of someone who's HIV positive from contracting TB. So you can make the connections here in terms of, you know, what it's contributing in terms of fatalities amongst inmates. HIV prevention is also unevenly and insufficiently delivered. Jake reported that 19% of centers did not have condoms available throughout. That's a big problem on its own, but condoms in and of themselves are not sufficient to protect inmates from HIV and STIs. Lubricants aren't distributed, and they're vital for the effective use of condoms, especially when having anal intercourse. And unprotected receptive anal intercourse is one of the riskiest ways to have sex in terms of your risk to contract HIV and STIs. So we urge the department again to revisit this and maybe incorporate lubricants into HIV policy as well. We understand, you know, service delivery is uneven. Some centers do really well, some centers do really poorly. But we noted that there's logistical challenges that often results, in our experience, to HIV-positive inmates not receiving their antiretrovirals on time or having long gaps in their access to antiretrovirals, which is, of course, very dangerous for them because adherence is really vital. And this interruption, of course, would not only affect people who are HIV-positive, but people who are suffering from TB. And again, adherence is vital because if you don't adhere properly on a daily basis, you can develop drug-resistant forms of the disease for both HIV and TB, which puts other inmates, the staff, and the community at risk. So we want to highlight that the logistical problem is happening and that it would be really vital to work with DCS to highlight what the blockages are in terms of delivery on this. The last thing I want to talk about is the contingent liability listed in Annex 2B of the report. It says there's 2.5 million contingent liabilities carried over from the last reporting period for rape. Again, the table is not very useful, but it does indicate the high cost that's being incurred by the department for not taking preventative action. But we just want to highlight the 4.5, although it already seems large, is probably not even the whole picture because it says rape, but it doesn't say anything about sexual assault. Those are two distinct crimes under the Sexual Offenders Act. We assume that also complaints being lodged about sexual assault. It lists pain and suffering separately, HIV separately. I'm sure when somebody's lodging a case because they're rape, there would very often overlap with pain and suffering and HIV. That's the contingent liability that actually is much higher. So it would be great to get assistance to get more information from the department in terms of how many cases have been lodged, what the results were, and how much it actually cost the department to not take preventative action for sexual abuse and HIV. And the last thing is I just wanted to support CSPRI and NICRO's submission made regarding the independence and effectiveness of the JICs, and we look forward to making a submission regarding that on the 30th. Thank you.
On the 31st. No, we'll take, who's the gentleman? Oh, we'll take
that would set the members.
All right, your input, sir, and then we will field questions.
Thank you very much. Ahmad Zarifa Temukama from ISIS. I just want to focus on three issues as per our submission. One is on vacancies, the issue of corporate governance within the DCS and also information technology governance. I think from the Auditor General, what is clear is that financial issues are simply not being adhered to within the DCS. I mean, it's very clear that we've got a public finance management act that is in place. It's a legal document. It's simply not adhering to it. And I think something that has been said over and over again, I was there earlier in the year for the budget, we said we raise the same issues. And I think we come here every year and we raise the same issues. So I really would like to ask the committee to ask the DCS to say what exactly are they doing, given that they also have problems with inaccurate information. And I think the technology has raised issues like misstatements that have been said, in some of the reports. So what exactly are they doing? And also, I think in previous years we've raised issues like the recruitment of finance professionals seems to be a problem within the DCS. And I think this impacts on the generation of information. So what exactly have they been doing and are they doing? Do they have a strategy in place going to the future? Because they do have a strategy every year we've got a strategic plan. So do they have a strategic plan to see that finance professionals are appointed, that information that is generated is robust and accurate? Because I think when we have inaccurate information, those avenues are for corruption, those are also dishonesty within the department. So I think those are questions that also need to be asked. I think we ask a simple question to say, what staffing strategy do they have? They do raise issues like, well, we know we're having learnerships and graduate training programs, but what strategy do they have in place to say once you have learnership programs, these people are going to stay within the DCS because you simply skill people and then they leave because it seems we're painting a very dire picture of what it is like to work within the DCS. So are people willing to stay there once they've gone through these graduate recruitment programs or just simply leave? Because they can find better jobs somewhere else. So what exactly do they have in terms of staffing strategy? And also the turnaround time, I think it's a perennial problem within the DCS in terms of recruiting professionals, that the turnaround time is very slow. So if they examine to say what causes this, and given that every year we still come back to say turnaround, every year we come back and say turnaround time for equipment. So what strategy is this in place? Because we can't go 3-4 years and we're still saying turnaround time after 3-4 years in the recruiting professionals. So I think we really need to look into those things. And then I think the other thing, I think it was raised by Reggie, that the issue of conflict of interest in the awarding of bids. And I think that we have got employees who are awarded contracts and then they don't, declare that they have interest in those. And I think most recently we have had the National Development Plan by the National Planning Commission, which simply says that certain types of economic activity should not benefit people in the public sector. I think if you want to do this, then you should leave the DCS and have a private company and bid for contracts for the DCS instead of remaining within the DCS. And then there seems to be some very manipulation of bids. It doesn't seem to be very, very, very clear. So I would like maybe the committee to ask the DCS to say, what exactly are they doing? I think it's the question that you've raised. What are they doing about employees who do not declare their interest in bids? And we seem to have a lot of, I think if you go through the annual report, there seem to be cases dating back to 2010, 2011 that seem to remain unresolved. The facts are there. I mean, there was conflict of interest. You were given a lead. You wait for the details. So what is the details doing about it? From 2010, that's almost 2 years ago, we discussed those employers. And I think the details is notorious. I think Gisamez is notorious on playing IT consultants. It's quite clear to me that when you pump millions of dollars into employing consultants to deal with IT, you don't have an IT governance framework in order, or what if there is not working. I'm just wondering whether these are not avenues for IT consultants to come back and do more, develop these policies. What exactly do they, I mean, given that it's a department that we know, you know, does rely heavily in terms of keeping records on IT, why don't they have an IT governance framework? Because it seems like the other general report seems to suggest that the framework that's there is ineffective. And they've employed consultants year in, year out to do this sort of thing. And this is from personal experience. I try and contact DCS and prefer it through emails. And one of the things, frequent things I get is maybe our emails are way down. You know, I emailed a guy on Monday last week. He says, no, I'm going to send you a report. Don't write about it. Just send me this email. And I sent an email 2 minutes afterwards. Then I call him 3-4 days later. And he says, well, maybe when you send the email, our emails are down. And yet I'm employing, you know, consultants to do this sort of thing. I would expect at least right now that you'd have working emails. And at least when the report is out, somebody from the DCS can say, we've got a list of stakeholders. Here's the annual report, and you email it out to everyone. And when you do email them, they have all sorts of issues going on. And I think it's really a representation of the kind of issues that we have. And I think when people are not forthcoming in giving stakeholders information, like annual report, I have severe problems trying to get the annual report. I think it also boils down to transparency and accountability. And I don't think they do take civil society seriously sometimes. They ask us to engage, but they do not give us the information that we require from them. I think that is a serious issue in terms of how we engage with the DCS. And I think lastly my point is that it seems to suggest that over the past couple of years from 2008, it seems the Indian population has stabilized. That we seem to have more or less a stable population. I would like the committee to perhaps ask the DCS to say, is there a point that when you come over, when you have a facility by facility breakdown, and if I missed it, it's in the annual report, but is there going to be a point where when you have a facility by facility breakdown of, the number of inmates, sentenced and sentenced offenders? Because it's all nice for them to say to us, well, we don't have a problem with overcrowding. But I think we need to have a picture to say, where is overcrowding a problem, and where is it not a problem? And given that they've had a stable prison population for the, I mean, if you look at the graphs on page 23 of the annual report, they seem to suggest that the prison population has been stable. So I think if it has been stable, we at least could expect some, you know, some minimum standards of main conditions to be met if it doesn't been fluctuating. I think these are just questions I would like the committee to ask the details in their exchange with them. Thank you very much.
Just take me back to the page where you said DCS says the criminal, the inmate population has stabilized. You mentioned the...
I didn't say that. I'm saying the graph on the annual report on page 23.
The graph of the annual report.
Yes, on page 23. the simplest I get to me is 25.
It's 25.
The annual report of the DCS.
Yes.
Not of DICS, of the DCS.
Yes, okay.
The simplest I guess we have had a stable population of the past 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
They right. seem to suggest. I'm not saying the things like
no,
suggest, but on paper they seem to suggest that. So I'm saying if they're working with a stable population, where there isn't fluctuating, and if it goes down, you have no excuse. If it goes down, it's going down, it's not. But if it's stable, at least we expect to say you are working with a stable number over 4 or 5 years. Why can't you at least ensure that that's stable population without saying, well, the number has been going up this year, so we can't manage them. But if it's stable, why can't at least, can you not expect them to meet some minimum standards in prison?
I understand you. The problem is that stable population are all overcrowded. That's the problem.
And the problem is that we do not have a center.
No, I agree. It should be readily available. They should be able to give you by center what is the capacity and what is the actual population. There should be. And we will raise it. My problem that I seem to be getting from you is the lack of willingness to share information.
Yes,
because when we ask for that information, we get given that information when we go to centers. But we will raise the relationship part of it. It should be readily available. On these two presentations, anybody, let's take, before I come to you, Sokala Nalma, you follow Baba Makakula, and then Munir Max will do the last one.
Thank you, Professor. Mine is on the health. I heard very indicating that only 9% of the inmates that are infected with HIV/AIDS are receiving ARV. And she's saying it's very, very little. I just want to know, what are you measuring that against? Because we have got a national policy on people who are supposed to receive HIV, antiretroviral. Then you also indicated that the DCS has a policy maybe on this. That is why it's only giving 69% of the inmates. So I just want to know whether is that a fact or something that we're thinking of. If it's a fact, can we be afforded the opportunity to know, to have that policy that they are using within the DCS? Because they can't be using something else other than the national policy that is there. Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson, also on health. I just want to get the clarity. First, it is, no matter, it is not just putting to the issue of the cameras, that we can put it in all the sites. Because really, we cannot allow the sodomization in our centers. So I think also that it just calm the situation of the transmitted of the disease. The other things to do. Yeah, I think that okay, makes sense. I think this issue of CCTV cameras in the center. And another thing that I want to ask is that I've been hearing you speaking about the condoms. In the female centers, those number that you mentioned is not affecting the female centers, or it's also affecting the female centers, the female centers. If it's affecting the female centers, the condom can be also used in the female centers, I mean the women condoms. So I just want to know, or in the female centers, the women are very sick. There is not any transmission of the disease. So I just want to know, so that when we are speaking about this thing, we have to be specific that no, we are speaking about male. Let me tell you this thing that I saw in Postback. I saw they were putting people in the cells, and then I find the two guys, they were in one cell. Then I ask, why you separate these two guys? They say, no, these are the gays. So really, it raised my eyebrow, because it means that no, if are the gays, maybe they mean that no, they can proceed to the gays activities. in the cell, really I didn't understand it. But we want you just to help us on that, so that we know that in all our centers, there is health and stability. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to, one question to the lady over there. I don't get the name now. But with regards to your thing, the increase in HIV positive or image, did you determine it is a result of your investigation? Is your finding, is it as a result of the department test more, because they are there, they test more, that's why there's an increase, or is it as a result of more infections? Thank you. That's all.
Okay, let me do my best. What I'm saying is I don't know how DCS is determining eligibility for HIV-positive inmates to access ARVs. And the 69% is only for inmates who have CD4 counts below 350. For inmates who are HIV-positive who are eligible, it's only 40% for accessing antiretroviral treatment. So I've heard from one person in DCS that they do follow the Department of Health guidelines, but the way it's reported might suggest that maybe it's different because it doesn't report along the same guidelines as according to the Department of Health guidelines. So I think it would be good to find out exactly how DCS determines who's eligible and who's not eligible. And what I was saying was that it might be good if the department differs in one respect from the Department of Health guidelines. That's because the Department of Health guidelines state that for inmates who have CD4 counts below 350, they're only eligible if they're also pregnant or have TB or at stage 4 of their infection. Because of the conditions inside prisons, we think that it would be good for inmates who have CD4 counts below 350 no matter what to be eligible for ARVs. Regarding CCTVs, I think I would make a submission when you called for that in civil society a few months ago, and we do believe that will help, especially in detecting and prosecuting after sexual abuse takes place. We don't know how much it would be a deterrent for sexual abuse, and we think nothing can really take away from the power of increased monitoring and in-person guarding and segregating people who are vulnerable from people who are more likely to perpetrate. In terms of condoms, I think the 19% not having condoms throughout did affect one female center noted in the JICS report that was Durban female. I don't know about the HIV levels amongst male or female inmates. I don't know the levels of rape and sexual assault amongst male or female inmates. That information is just not available. But I do know that sexual abuse does also, of course, impact female inmates. And it takes place between female inmates and also, of course, between staff and inmates. So it's a challenge that affects both, and a comprehensive policy would benefit both female and male inmates. In terms of inmates who identify to be gay being housed separately, I imagine it's because they're more vulnerable to being targeted for sexual abuse. There's a lot of homophobia and stigma against and discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender inmates, and kind of this perverse assumption that people who are gay can actually be raped because they enjoy having anal sex. It's just simply not true. So there's just a lot of stigma about that. But it is better to separate people who are gay from those who are more likely to commit sexual abuse. But they shouldn't be punished by being put in a single cell unless that's what they would prefer. You know, they shouldn't be isolated just because they're coming out as gay. In terms of the increase in HIV-positive inmates, I think maybe you misunderstood what I was stating. There's an increase in the number of inmates that have been tested for HIV. The report does not give any information on the number of recorded number of inmates who have HIV. That's not available. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a general point that we've been grappling with as a committee for a while. Around this very sensitive issue of sexual abuse, sexual preferences, and so on.
And maybe you guys must think about it and give us your views. You know, we are not sure of the advisability of having men in a female section, for instance. Men waters where the females. I'm raising the issue that you're raising, that it's not just inmate on inmate. Sometimes it's official on inmate. Or vice versa. Should we have females in a high-profile men's center? The other side of the coin, though, is that if we say men must only be where men are and women must only be where women are, I'm not sure what the situation now, but Boxburg had a female area commissioner, for instance, and Boxburg got a male center. So if we told that first line, it means we will then, by definition, be discriminating against people from working. But it's really something that we're going to have to take a hard look at. Maybe we must accept the discrimination because of the bigger good of not having the Riksdag. Or if we say that we can't discriminate, then we must accept there's going to be this type of thing. But for me, it just doesn't make sense to have any men waters in a female only section. It doesn't make sense for me. But it's something that I think we will have to, once we've won the fight on CCTV cameras, we'll embark on this. Because it really is something that we're going to have to take up sooner rather than later. Thank you very much. It is, we think, very well. You, between the two of you, you've got 15 minutes. Or between all of us, your input and our questions, we've got 15 minutes. Can we start with you, Vanessa, and then we go on to Dr. Muting, and then members can engage if you want to engage, and we will then adjourn.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go straight to the recommendations section, the last section, page 29. I'm going to try not to repeat what others have said, but given my introduction of the document, I just talked about South African society, and I think it's important that I mention it, that our society's social fabric is very scarred, and incarceration is continuing to contribute to that. We see the overcrowding levels at 36%, and I think it's to do with structural issues, it's to do with the same issues over and over again. Recidivism is high, meaning for us to continue not to address rehabilitation, not to address reintegration, we are causing the cycle. It's not good enough that the prison population is stable. It is so overcrowded. And it seems that one thing leads to the other. So if we don't have a major shift, we will not likely to see any shift in any of these numbers. We've been saying it over and over again. Create alternatives, imprisonment, last resort, rehabilitate, put efforts into social reintegration. Because the fabric of our society is the way it is because family units are being disrupted. These offenders, the majority of them, come from already marginalized dysfunctional families. There's poverty. Incarceration creates more poverty. It's like an unending cycle, and something has to shift. Otherwise, we're really not going to see any progress with this in this regard. However, everything is linked to that. Just then, in terms of some of our key proposals, I mean, second time and time again, we talked about alternatives. I'm not going to go into it, but we in particular, want to draw your attention to those serving sentences under 24 months. Currently, we know there's no correctional sentencing plans for them. So basically, they're warehoused in prisons for 2 years, and which has a negative effect on them and creates worse people coming out. So I think seriously, we really need to consider what we do with those under 24 months. I know there's this whole thing, let's finish the over 24 months for correctional plans. The DCS annual report talks about dedicated facilities. We shouldn't be spending money on dedicated facilities for under 24 months. We should rather those people, they should be conversions to non-custodial centers. And I know the DCS always says this is not our role, but there's very specific provisions for the DCS to do their part. There is where the National Commissioner can grant bail to those who can't afford it and release people on correctional supervision. So there's some important things the DCS can do and they're not doing. I know a couple of years ago there was a particular case that happened and the DCS and there was some legal implications, so we feel personally, I mean, Mikro's opinion is that maybe that's why the DCS is hesitant to use those options. But I think we have a serious problem if we continue to proceed. And then obviously the greater issue is the KCPS cluster and dealing with sentencing. I think we're just like very frustrated with the process of the alternatives that don't seem to be properly supported. And I did mention there the Section 63A, the Correctional Services Act talks about the DCS's role.
And I think Emily has talked a lot about the policy on sexual abuse, and just to finalize, that needs to be finalized. I think I wanted to make one point about that. And we talked about vulnerabilities. Then the other issue is, in the report, 68% of external programs, the correctional programs, were currently provided by, 68% of correctional programs were provided by external service providers. I just want to raise the issue again about the role of non-governmental organizations. In point number four, we talk about, we are starting to get funding for social reintegration from the Department of Social Development. They have told us straight that this is not their, it's not something that should come from their budget. And so we have a crisis in terms of who's going to fund our reintegration services. And I think it is really ridiculous when there's a role and a budget that a DDS can allocate to it. And I think, as a person, I have written to you about the crisis that we're having amongst NGOs and CBOs, and a large number of them are servicing the Department of Correctional Service with no compensation. And the department has mentioned the financing policy, but I mean, I think it's been 3 years down the line and we have had no further input. And I think it's unfair, not just to non-governmental organizations, but to people of South Africa. Because the sustainability of the services that we invest in, that are based on evidence-based practice, are in jeopardy, and to lose the lives of those we serve are if it doesn't get funded. And I think it's a great situation that we're facing. You've seen huge NGOs close and shut down. The Restorative Justice Center was one that happened recently. But I really think that's what we're asking, for an engagement between those that work in correctional environments and the Department of Correctional Services, to really look at a resourcing strategy that's properly funded, which should include compensation for these organizations doing services in these facilities. And I think if we really find a way to work together, it could address some of those critical skills vacancies. I'm not saying it's a long-term solution, but it could help at least for now, where there's social work services that are missing, psychological services and all of that. Then there's another particular thing, point number five, is the halfway house. In the annual report, the DCS says that there's a business plan that has been submitted to the National Commissioner around the halfway house funding model, which is what we feel is totally inadequate. The halfway house model is wanting to fund only the administrative costs of a halfway house from the DCS side and expecting the NGO to go find the funding. Now, that's not a sustainable model given the crisis in funding at the moment. And it's a huge problem. We know how IDPs, halfway houses, have a very good chance of succeeding if we do this properly from a partnership and collaborative point of view. But we for instance, Nicola, partnering with Prison Care and Support Network, we've got a halfway house. We went to the DCS, they said they cannot fund in this cycle. But the point of the matter, it's been a year or more, and we still haven't got funding to start the program. So these are just some of the challenges. And it's, yeah, just something we need to relook at. Already that business plan is going, so if you have to ask that DCS just to look at it, and it's going to come up in a budget issue. But I think it's problematic and it's not likely to succeed going forward. And then with regard to, I don't think we can, the issue of criminal records come up again and again, and the DCS has mentioned it in the annual report. And I think Lucas has written about it previously, and I think we really need to look at the issue of criminal record is causing huge problems in offenders securing employment and being stigmatized as a result of it, and then the unending cycle of crime and violence continues. So at some point out there, I'd like to urge the committee to really open that issue and look at it again, especially because there's a 10-year period before someone can apply for that expungement in some instances. So that may need us looking at legislation again to see if we can open it up for offenders to at least secure employment. Then in terms of improving parole, I think there's been a deliberation around that. What we want to say in point number seven is just we need a more effective system of assessment, supervision, and programming that will enhance public safety, reduce recidivism, and enhance program and service integrity. Nicola are increasingly engaging with community corrections and forming partnerships, unfunded partnerships, but nevertheless, at least that's moving forward, but more needs to be done there. Because otherwise, if that doesn't get done, recidivism increases and we go back to people back in prison and you're dealing with the same issue over and over again. Then, with regard to the monitoring when it comes to overcrowding and gang management, I want to agree with the IDS and on the reporting per facility. I think it's very important to see that these are implemented. And with regard to the gang management strategy, the annual report still doesn't refer to what exactly are they doing in terms of gangs, and in which facility is implemented, what are the successes, what has worked, what hasn't worked. I think the committee should really ask for a full report. And I think probably they will, given it's a strategy, but... And they also talk about implementation of panic buttons, and we don't know where those are and how widely spread they are. There's training, how is training in human rights approach, has it worked? How do you change mindset of DCS officials? There's just too many questions regarding it. Then there's another important thing we picked up at point number 11. There was the inmate identification, electronic identification program that couldn't be implemented because inmates did not have green barcoded IDs. I mean, seriously, they don't have identity documents, and how do we know they move in our facilities? And I mean, we just thought of a practical idea. I know with rural people, we did a project where we got people registered with Home Affairs, and I don't know if it's something that DCS would consider doing to get people registered. So I think it's important that they have identification. How do we... No, not electronic monitoring. There's an inmate identification program that was identified that wasn't implemented because inmates didn't have green barcoded identification documents. So I'm saying, what form of identification do they have? And then if they don't have identification, how do we know who's in our prisons? So we're just suggesting that some kind of project be done to have people with Home Affairs have identification done, yeah, which will then help that inmate identification project. Then we talked, previously Nicola has mentioned this time and time again about rehabilitation being mandatory, especially some core correctional programs. I know in sentencing, they sometimes, the judiciary put sentencing programs in, but I think we should not be giving inmates the option to attend correctional programs. We're given the option to whether or not to go to prison, but prisons are supposed to be rehabilitated. So why are we giving them the option to be rehabilitated? It does not make sense to me. And we find far too many inmates lying around idle, and it's just, I don't know, it's just not at all acceptable. I think we talked about the mental illness, and you know Nicola's position on that, and we still feel that things are very inadequate in terms of meeting the needs of mental health in ill people in prison and those with drug addiction problems. Number 15 is just with regard to creating more humane alternatives for incarcerated women and their children. I think Trill has, in the report itself, you will see a case study where we dealt with a baby who was removed from the mother when he was two, and the mother hadn't seen the child for 2 years when we intervened. And the whole problem was is that in terms of these cases, the children's court inquiry is not getting open when the children have been placed. They appear at a normal magistrate's court. The magistrate asks the foster parent and the inmate who's in prison how they arrange a visit. There's no court mandate, and then they go away. And the Department of Social Development, because of problems with transport, sometimes the inmate is housed 200 kilometers away from the child. For 2 years, his mother didn't see the child, and her thing was that the judge said she could see him every second month. When we eventually brought the Department of Social Development, it was unbelievable, the judgment, the Department of Social Development felt that the best interest of this child should have no contact with this mother. And that does not meet the rights of inmates and mothers in particular. And so we had a family group conference, and we found that because there was no court mandate, they didn't feel that they needed to meet the requirement to make visits. So we rearranged that these visits be done. But I think it's problematic, so more needs to be looked at in children, just setting up child and mother units, but exactly how these processes are happening, because I think there's gaps. With regard to, I think the last point I'm going to just talk about is offender labor opportunity and issues of self-sufficiency. I was just listening to the problems we're having with contractors, and we have lots of ex-offenders coming out of prison who have skills in building. And I think this whole link with offender labor opportunities and self-sufficiency, we could, and I think you've asked the question before, why aren't we using inmates to do things in correctional facilities? And I think still we're not making maximum opportunity to create more self-sufficiency, which is a legal requirement for the department and a policy issue, and using inmate labor, which is still not used properly. And just in the grime, the dilapidated correctional environment, the thing that says crime and grime, the more grime there is and more dilapidated the place is, the more likely crime is to flourish. And that's what it seems like within the Department of Correctional Services, if it's looking dilapidated, and I think that contributes to staff morale and a whole lot of other things. Okay, so I think that's more or less our issues.
Okay, I'll be a quick chairperson. Just a side comment on the issue of statistics raised by the ISS, and Mr. Carlson may be able to confirm this. The last audited statistics I saw on DCS's management information system was for February 2011. And this is cause for concern for me because it means we are operating with figures that are not reliable. The actual offender statistic is the management reports. In other words, it tells us the profile of prisoners, where they are, at which exact facility, how overcrowded capacity, the issue you raised, Chair. I've been listening to the submissions this afternoon, and I think in many regards the situation seems like it's getting worse. And one gets a sense of a department that is directionless. And maybe part of the reason for that is that, as the annual report states on page 179, that one out of five senior management positions are vacant. So these are the top people in the department. One out of five is not there. And I think we start seeing the implications of this throughout. The main point I want to raise here is that in the annual report on page 28, the department proposes that to implement the seven-day establishment, they need to employ an additional 18,430 people at a cost of 4.8 billion rand per year. Now, if they do that, it will bring the offender or prisoner and official to prisoner ratio down from 3.9 to 2.7. So we can do that at 4.8 billion rand a year. The alternative is that we reduce the number of prisoners to get to the same ratio, which means that we will need to reduce the prison population by roughly 50,000. Those are the two options. As much as our project stands for prison reform and that people should have adequate protection while in prison, I find it very difficult to understand how employing an additional 18,000 people would make the situation better if we're sitting with a department that is already struggling with governance issues, with discipline issues, all issues that were raised by the Auditor General in his report, where performance monitoring is not being done properly, information is accurate. So by adding 4.8 billion rand to the budget and 18,000 people, we're only going to end up with an incredibly well-resourced problem that is probably more complex than what it already is. So I really wish to emphasize this with the committee when it speaks to the department. So in terms of reducing the prison population, we raise a few issues there. I'm not going to go into it in detail, but reducing prison populations means that there must be a concerted effort on the part of government through the criminal justice system and a proper policy framework to say we want to send fewer people to prison. And it has been done in other countries, and the results have been positive in those countries. The one main contributor to the woes of our criminal justice system is unnecessary arrest by the police. Of the 1.4 million arrests by the police last year, 53% were for crimes less serious than shoplifting. A lot of those people end up in detention unnecessarily because the police are chasing arrest targets. We're also sitting with 11,000 people serving life imprisonment. In 1995, there were 400, but this is the result of mandatory minimum sentences. So roughly 3,000 bed prisons are booked out for the next 25 years.
I think we need to go back to our sentencing reform positions and see, is this the right approach? Is this really working for us? Vanessa raised the under 24 months. People, I'm not going to repeat that point. Last year we did research on children in South African prisons. That report has been available to the committee members recently. We would be happy to provide an additional briefing. I'm not going to deal with that. Safe to say that there's a lot of inconsistent practices. We have prisons like Randfley that is run exceptionally well. It's really the benchmark. And not far from there, in the same management area, is a prison where virtually no services are available. The conclusion I draw from that is that it is not policy and law that is driving performance, but individual personalities in the department, and that is not the way it should be. This submission also deals with discipline, and I will only look at one graph there on page 9, and it shows the percentage of disciplinary actions for fraud, corruption, and theft out of the total number of disciplinary actions. And what it shows is the tremendous fluctuations from around about 10% up to 14%, even up to 13% of total actions, and then it drops to 2% and 4% in the following years. What my analysis of it is that these peaks in fraud and corruption cases were the results of external agencies like the SIU and the Jali Commission investigating fraud and corruption in the department, and that you see these spikes in disciplinary actions. But since then, they've dropped tremendously. And I think the reason lies in that the department's code enforcement unit does not have the skill and the capacity to investigate more complex fraud and corruption cases. The result is that we are now creating a risk for the department for increased fraud and corruption if this is not addressed quite soon. And then the last point I want to make is the turnstiles. Mangwenya already raised the Sondolo IT and Pazulu fencing contracts. This was also part of that. The annual report notes on page 48 and 49 that 27% of the intended 78 turnstiles are currently operational. These turnstiles were bought at great expense, and ultimately a quarter of them is functioning. And I think one really needs to ask the questions, how did a situation like this develop? Can it be fixed? And how can we prevent that it repeats itself? Because again, an external contractor is being pulled in to do the maintenance and updating of the systems. And if the root of the problem is not addressed, we'll sit exactly with the same problem 3 years from now. We're sitting with expensive equipment that is not being used. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Just two or three questions I think are very useful. The real question that you're asking is, do we employ 18,000 more or do we reduce staff? If we went the reduced staff route, we're talking about the less than 24 months going for term and sentences type of thing. Where else do we see, and also the fact that police can't arrest to investigate type of thing, that will also help. Is there any other areas other than those that we should be saying the department must consider? I mean, clearly the police one have always argued about it. The less than 24 months is something we've been talking about. Where else do we see reducing? If we must reduce rather than... Because the other side of the argument is, what is it? We can't even build more prisons because it's not going to be the solution to the staff versus inmates. All right. That's something that we will raise with them. And I think we take the point. I mean, thanks for sitting at Mamboya. I think now we realize that it means that if you're in life for the next 25 years, at least 4 of our prisons are fully booked. No Maganda, they're just fully booked for the next 25 years. If we take it at 3,000 per whatever. So when we look at reducing overcrowding, we must already just count five facilities. All right, now that's very useful. All right, just as the members have any questions of clarity, I thought it was very clear. We will certainly take these things up. All right. Thank you to everybody for attending. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I thought you asked a question of where else can we reduce. The waiting trials, obviously, the under 34 months, and then obviously sentence lengths. We saw that sentence lengths increased. So in fact, over the last 6 years, the number of sentenced people admitted to prisons reduced by 50%. We're sending fewer people to prison, but they're staying there for so much longer. And that is a function of mandatory minimum sentences, the increase in the sentence jurisdiction of the courts. So we may need to go look at how our parole administration is, but that is also something that this committee has struggled with in the past, and we never went back to the incarceration framework. I didn't think that was a good idea to start off with. But the sentence length is definitely a major factor to the problem.
Thank you very much to our colleagues. It was a long day, but perhaps it was very useful. I think we'll be able to engage much more meaningfully. Thank you so much. I look at the boss. I think. Hey? We start at 10 tomorrow. Doing what? Oh, the judicial inspector is coming forward. We start at 10 tomorrow. No, I was looking at the boss because normally these things are open, so that you don't have to take our word. You can come and observe if we are really going to raise some of the issues we raised, but it really depends on the venue and the space, I think. But definitely the judicial inspectors will have an idea over and above our own, the type of thing that will come up. So it starts at 10 tomorrow in M46, I think. And on Tuesday, to the department, the venue is? You don't know. Also morning. Okay. So Tuesday, also around about 9-10 o'clock in the good old chamber, where we'll be dealing with the department, tomorrow with the judicial inspectorate and his annual report. And I suppose if there is space availability, you're more than welcome. But we will make an undertaking to raise some of your points. Not all, we'll raise some of them and we'll continue to raise them as we meet the department. So thank you very much. We all see each other tomorrow in M46 at 10 o'clock. Meeting is adjourned.
Is aware, but yeah, it doesn't look good, eh?
No, man, it's very bad, man. Yeah, man, it's very bad. But we are not here in the combat, man. I think we're in there. But I'm telling you, I'm drunk, it will not buy Paribandri.
Well, but you can hear it from the winter's point of view, Rish. It looks like we are not doing well.
Yeah, but it's not very good, man. But look at the shakti.